DHS review. It is the 11th of January. It's 9 a.m. or a little bit after, and we have a good agenda and some important issues to deal with. And we'd like to begin. We'll be opening an organizational meeting to deal with adopting the task force rules, so that we can have our task force in proper organization
here.
Has everyone had the opportunity to look at the rules that were promulgated and sent to us by email?
Mr. Chair, this is the first time I've seen them. If we could take just a minute to review, I'd like to do that.
Okay.
I've been out of the office the last couple of days, and so the email probably crossed.
We have tens of thousands of people watching us on the Internet, but we'll wait.
Just take me just a minute. These rules are similar to the rules we normally use.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are the standard rules. They have not changed from what were adopted during session.
All right. I'm ready then, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Right. I move that the draft rules for the House Interim Task Force on DHS review be adopted.
Representative, wasn't it moves that the draft rules for the House Interim Task Force on DHS review be adopted? Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Those of the opinion that the draft rules be adopted will say aye.
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 No. The draft rules have been adopted. Before we get into our full agenda, I would like to take just a minute to let those that are tuned in know what we're going to be doing today. The purpose of today's meeting is to have conversation with DHS on the proposed or the announced $172 million shortfall that will exist if the forecasts are correct by the end of this biennium. I want everyone who is tuned in on via the Internet and otherwise to know that the shortfall is from a budget that's between $9.8 billion and $10 billion. It does not mean that benefits are going to be cut off today or in the near future, or that paychecks are not going to be received. We're talking about a shortfall in a budget that must be dealt with, but we want to deal with it in a very logical and rational fashion. And so the purpose today is to find out what the components are of that shortfall, how that number was determined, whether or not the number is accurate, and what we can do to help assure that we have accurate information in the future, what we can do to help at least work on the process of having less violent swings from these forecasts. If we look back at things that have happened with DHS and the e-board and the legislature dealing with financial matters in the last year, we've seen some fairly huge swings, and that always causes some real angst and some problems. And so we want to see what we can do to improve that. And so we're looking forward to getting some really important information from DHS today. Are there any opening comments that any of our committee would like to make?
Mr. Chair.
Task force, yes.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't on Human Services during the session, and I'm sure when you went through this on the Ways and Means, you looked at their forecasting. Do we have a record for the last four sessions of how it's looked? Have they been, this much short, this much over? Do we have numbers that look at the last four budgets instead of just this budget?
When we have, Representative, wasn't it, when we have the DHS leaders up at the table, we can ask them that question, and they can provide that kind of information. We don't have it before us today.
Thank you.
Well, if there's no other questions or comments at this point, let's go ahead and begin our informational meeting. And I'd like to begin by just stating that we have tremendous respect for the Department of Human Services and for the thousands of dedicated workers that help provide some of the most life-saving and important services to the most needy members of our communities throughout Oregon. And I want to take just a moment and share a couple of the successes that I haven't mentioned to Director Goldberg or others, but I'd like you to know that DHS is doing a great job in a lot of areas. A comparison with the other states has recently come out, and these are some of the things that they say about Oregon. In the past year, the percentage of children in poverty has decreased from 20.1% to 15.6% of persons under the age of 18. I mean, that is a huge reduction, and that didn't just happen because the economy got better. In the past year, the rate of motor vehicle deaths declined from 1.5 to 1.3 deaths per 100,000 miles driven. Since 1990, the infant mortality rate has decreased from 9.9 to 5.7 deaths per 1,000 live births. And since 1990, the incident of infectious disease declined from 92.8 to 16 cases per 100,000 population. I mean, that is significant. And then when they compare the improvements in overall health between the various states, I was really pleased to see that Oregon has risen to, it's like the number one most improved. And that is something that I don't understand why it's happened, but it certainly needs to be pointed out that we have a tremendous improvement in the health care as far as our comparisons with the other states in the nation. Now, that having been said, you know, the organization has hundreds of programs and has just as so many areas that that have to be dealt with, and it is so complex and so involved. I mean, the forecasts and the funding that we receive from the federal government and the number of caseloads in these various programs, all of these things come into the mix, and it makes it very complicated. And we have a situation that has developed with this $172 million shortfall, and we want to address that. And so we're going to invite the director and his associates and leadership for DHS to come forward, and as they do that, we'd like to hear from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're passing out some attaboys while they're coming forward, I was very close to a lot of the Katrina relief activities that were occurring in Portland, both as we were preparing to get the airlifts that didn't happen, and then over 700 people from the New Orleans and Gulf Coast areas arrived in Portland pretty much on their own. And I'd just like to publicly thank the department for incredible response that DHS did in terms of participating in that whole coordinated relief effort that occurred at Washington Monroe, and the department acted very quickly and did an incredible job, and as did everybody that was working there. But I was very pleased to see that DHS was able to respond as quickly and as confidently as they were able to.
We applaud the efforts to that has been extended to show that kind of compassion for those that are in such great need. And we're a long ways from the Gulf Coast states, but those that came have had their needs met. This is going to be kind of a fluid presentation. We'd like to have you take charge, representing our Director Goldberg, and then we will invite the panel as we go along to ask questions.
Certainly. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the compliments. I'd love to be able to take credit for all those things, the reduction of infant mortality and what we've done in terms of the reduction in motor vehicle deaths, and even the efforts the state made in Katrina relief. I think that those are all indications of not just the Department of Human Services, but it's how we all work together as a state, whether it's a variety of state agencies or it's people out in our communities, providers of services, et cetera, who are a big piece of what that is. And so, you know, the successes are what we all do together. And I appreciate the recognition and the fact that there are things that we do well and there are things that we can do better. And, you know, we look forward, and I look forward to looking at the things that we need to do better and do better at them, and so that we can do as good as we can to improve the organization and delivery of human services in the state, and have DHS be the kind of organization where people are proud to work in and where people in the state are proud to have it working for them. With that said, what we'd like to do, if that's okay, is I know that one of the big issues that you'd like to discuss is the $172 million projected shortfall, And what we're prepared to do is I'd like to provide some sort of introductory context to that just for a moment or two, and then Vic Todd will walk through actually line by line all of the issues that comprise that $172 million. Great. So, you know, with that said, you know, we've provided some information, and you all have that before you that indicates that the department is looking at a projected $172 million budget shortfall. That's really, there are three things primarily that are driving that, that I'll summarize at a high level, and then we'll look through program by program, line by line, and be able to give you, I think, the detail that we all require. The largest driver is caseload and cost per case increases, and that's $119.2 million of the total. And the largest factor in that are increases in needs for the Oregon Health Plan. The cost per case and the caseload increases are really increases over what was projected in the spring forecast. And we're also prepared to talk about the issues around forecasting as well when we get through looking at line by line the budget, because I think one of the other issues here is, you know, first and foremost, looking at line by line where what comprises this. I think then what I'd like to do once we go through that is to talk with you a little bit about some of the ways that I'm looking at addressing some of that to be certain that it doesn't happen again and that we can move forward with some confidence so that we don't see the types of swings and issues that were portrayed in the opening comments. The second piece that's driving the budget shortfall is a decline in our federal match rate for our Medicaid programs. That will begin October 1st, 2006, and comprises $23.83 million. Every year, the federal government recalculates every state's federal match rate. And it's based on a formula which takes 3 years of average, I believe it's per capita income for the state, and compares that to the federal average. There have been years when our match rate has increased, and we've benefited from increased federal dollars. Beginning October 1, 2006, our match rate will decrease, and we will have some decreased federal dollars. That was not known when the budget was built, and we became this new match rate became available in September, October, and that's why it now appears before us in this current rebalance. The last issue are some roll-up costs of revenue shifts and shortfalls from the 2003-2005 biennium that roll up into the 2005-2007 biennium, and we're prepared to also go through that and explain why that is, and that's $30 million. That takes us to approximately $173.04 million, I believe, if my math is correct. And we also have, you know, seen some other issues, which we'll go through, that result in some savings of approximately $0.98 million. And that gets us to the $172 million figure. In our rebalance letter, to which will be before the e-board the end of next week, we also have identified $4 million in administrative savings that the department is prepared to take, looking at such issues as not filling vacancies, holding positions vacant, some decreases in supplies, travel, in terms of our administrative expense that totals approximately $4 million. And that's what gets you to that $168 million figure at the bottom of the page. And with that, what we could do now with that as sort of an orientation is walk through line by line what got us to that $172 million, if that's okay.
Any questions before we start going through the document? Resident Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if you could put in context this the shortfall. I mean, the DHS budget, of course, has existed for a long time. I suspect because of the size of it that it isn't always exactly right on the money. Are there other sessions in which we've either had shortfalls or surpluses, and could you tell us a little bit about that?
Having been at the job now for about 9 weeks, I'm really not prepared to talk about the history, but you know, Vic Todd might be able to shed a little bit of light on that.
For the record, my name is Vic Todd. I'm an assistant director for finance and policy. Chair and Representative Barnhart, you're correct that in every biennium, as we end the biennium and go through the biennium, there are always a list of issues, generally not of this magnitude in terms of the net bottom line, but there are always puts and takes. There are federal law changes, state changes, things that we thought we could implement that we can't. So this is obviously a large deficit.
I think this is the largest recently. We had, right after Measure 37, went down $117.2 million of excess funds that were able to be used for backfill. At the end of the last session, there were $77 million short. That's where we had the loan from the legislature. We met in October, and they were $55 million short in being able to pay back that $77 million, and now we're at $172. Mm-hmm. So that's just the last couple of years. Do you have a follow-up question?
Well, I guess I wanted to note that there have been, and I think, Mr. Chair, that you've dealt with that, that there have been biennia in which the department has returned funds to the Treasury, as well as biennia in which it's been necessary to backfill.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Goldberg, thank you. The $1 million and the $4 million, are those one-time savings?
Yeah, the $4 million administrative reductions are one-time savings for this biennium, yes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, as I stated earlier, in your presentation, if not today, you could provide the committee sort of a chart or showing us what the last four budgets have looked for as far as... like the Representative Barnhart said, you know, how bad is this compared to those? We found the money for the 117. Also, if you look at, you know, when you did the, you talked to us by telephone or had a conference, the 9%, if you look at the $37 million for blind and disabled and the $38 million for the temporary aid to needy families is $75 million,
right?
And you contribute caseload significant 9 and 15. So I hope in your presentation you'll tell us, what's the top and the bottom of that in the past sessions? Is that one? Why is that 9%? We didn't figure and things like that. But because if you take away those two, then you're probably back in the average of what we've looked at as far as shortfalls in the past. But especially in blind and disabled and temporary aid to needy families. I hope your comment on those during your presentation. Thank you.
Let me, if I might just put a little context around that, Chair Richardson, Representative Wisnett. You're correct, and you know the issue is that of that $119 million of caseload and cost per case, somewhere in the vicinity of $87 million is attributed to Oregon Health, the increasing need in the Oregon Health Plan. And that is above what was forecasted in the spring. In the spring, there was a forecast that projected a caseload in a number of our programs. And now in the fall, there's a forecast that indicates that the need will be higher. And the two places are, the largest drivers of that financially are, number one, increases in the aged, blind, and disabled within the Oregon Health Plan, and increases in the TANF program. And we'll be able to go through some of that as well, and why that was, and some of the factors that we're looking at to be certain that, you know, we improve the accuracy and validity of some of those forecasts.
We will discuss that after we've gone through the shortfall. We need to discuss specifically forecasting, because in some of the areas, such as TANF, the actual utilization in the last 6 months has not been as high as the forecast has indicated it would be for the average for this biennium. And so the actual trend in some of the caseloads are down from what was forecast in the fall, and so the hole may not be as large as it's expected based on just the forecast that we got in the fall. It's still huge, it's just that it may not be as large. Yes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't need an answer now, but through the course of the information that you're giving me, I feel fairly comfortable in terms of understanding the dynamics of the growth of the caseload. But could you, I would like to know, in terms of the overall shortfall, the difference between, you've mentioned increased cost per case, and which is obviously healthcare costs are going up, and we're all aware of that. But to try and understand what the dynamic or the percentage is in terms of the cost growth compared to the case, and how much of the problem is caused by more cases, and how much is caused by increased cost per case.
Vic will be going through each of those.
Okay, and by the way, we'd like to welcome to the dais Representative Thatcher, who is not on this task force, but she's invited to just join us. She'd like to participate. Also, the chair of the task force on the Oregon Health Plan, co-chair, is Bob Jensen. He serves with Representative Bruce Hansen, and before we're done, he may become available to plug in by telephone, and so we have a conference capability here when he becomes available. He'd like to join us. With that, Todd.
Okay.
Oh, there is one other thing. For those that are watching this from a distance or at home, we have the document that Mr. Todd is about to go through uploaded onto the Internet, so that if you're not here, you can go onto our website and find this document and then see the actual figures. We had it uploaded today. It's at www.leg.state.or.us/EHS_review. I'll give that to you one more time. It's www.leg.state.or.us/DHS_review, so that you can actually pull this up on the Internet and follow along with us if you're listening to this broadcast somewhere. So, Mr. Todd.
Again, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. And what I'm going to do is to start on page 2 of the document and just walk through each line item. And if you have questions, we can stop and talk through those. I'm going to begin with children's, adults, and families. And their overall projected need at this point is an additional $24.49 general fund. Beginning with items 1 and 2, that will appear in all of the clusters. Item 1 is the federal match rate issue that Bruce mentioned, and this affects every cluster. And it's a little less than 0.5% reduction in the general program match rate that's used for the last three quarters of the biennium, and that's a $1.6 million general fund issue for the children's, adults, and families. And if I use acronyms, I apologize now because I almost did say CAP, and I'll try to avoid that. But
thank you, because a lot of people that are listening in are trying to understand what's going on, and they're not used to the acronyms. And I can just mention that we're looking at the summary of major issues for 2005-07 rebalance. And so that's the document. We're on page 2, children, adults, and family. And when we're talking about match rate, we're talking about the participation of the federal government in Medicaid and in providing of services. And the better the economy in a state, the lower the percentage of federal money. Is that basically what we're correct? And so because Oregon's getting better, we have a reduction of 0.5%?
Chair Richardson, it's how we compare to the national average. So a state's economy may get better or worse, and its match rate may not go up or down. It really depends on how it compares to how other states are doing. So...
Okay, well, the comparison of Oregon is such that we're losing 0.5% of the federal participation for match rate,
correct.
And that doesn't begin until October 1st of 06.
That's correct.
And so it's only going to actually affect this 24-month budget by 9 months, the last 9 months or so. Is that correct?
And yet
it's still. That's correct. October 1, 2006 through June 30th, 2007.
Okay. Thank you.
Item number two is related to the $30 million roll-up issues related to both cost allocation and revenue shortfalls that were identified in the 0305 closeout at October, and that represents about a $2.3 million general fund issue for CAF. The next item is a caseload issue related to the temporary assistance to needy families. This is the cash assistance side, often referred to as TANF. The employment-related daycare program, TANF-related domestic violence. And this program actually was not fully funded coming into the biennium, and so this estimate goes back. April of 04, I think, was the last in terms of what was included budgetarily. So overall, that presents a $3.9 million general fund problem. Within this, we've also identified an additional $17 million of TANF federal fund revenues that can be used. So it helps mitigate what would have been a very large general fund problem. Item number four, Oregon was awarded a $1.1 million TANF high performance bonus. Related to increasing the percent of TANF clients that are placed into employment. It was one of nine states, and that saves about $1.1 million general fund.
Congratulations, that's good. People are getting jobs, that's becoming more self-sufficient.
Item number five is related to the food stamp caseload, number of households. While this doesn't present a general fund issue, it's about a 2% increase over the forecast that was used for the ledge adopted budget, and increases about 4,600 cases, and that's roughly a $31.6 million federal fund increase. Within child welfare, we have increased forecast estimates related to foster care, both the regular and special rates foster care, and that represents a $13.3 million increase in general fund. There's also a program other fund revenue issue that was identified in the 0305 closeout of about $2.9 million that's included in this as well. Adoptions assistance also is included in that $13 million total. It's expected to be higher than the LAB caseload, about 218, and cost per case is down there, about 939. In most of these displays, we'll have both a caseload and caseload shift identified. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Flores,
thank you, Mr. Todd. Could you give us a little bit further information about the adoption assistance payments as children may move from foster care and into adoption, how and why those payments continue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I'm probably not the best person to address that, but
We could ask Ramona Foley to come and address that.
Thank you.
I might mention that this area of the budget, which are assistance or payments to parents after they've adopted children, has become a very large segment, and it increases dramatically every biennium. About 10 years ago, it was $23 million. During the 2003-2005 period, I believe it was $83 million, and now for the 2005-2007, it's over $100 million. And these are payments to families after children have been adopted, and they continue throughout their minority until they're 18. And my understanding is that they're not means tested, and so that even a family that has substantial assets and income also can receive this. It's focused on the child, not on the parent's income. Is that correct?
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, for the record, my name is Ramona Foley with Children, Adults, and Families at DHS. And, Chair, you are correct. Several years ago, I'm guessing maybe it was 10 years ago, Congress took some action to try to remedy the problem of children remaining in foster care, not being adopted, because if they were adopted, there was no way to fund their care, their room and board, in the adoption setting. And Congress's thinking behind that, as it was explained to us working in the states, was that it is still a cost savings for the state because the case is actually closed in terms of not having a caseworker assigned. So it's no longer an active foster care case. There's no longer any court activity hearing the case. There's no longer a CASA. There's no longer a Citizens Review Board. It was to enable a child to move to adoption and not be penalized by the lack of the board payment. And what happens is adoption assistance, unless there's an exceptional medical need or physical need, for example, the payment cannot be greater than what the foster care payment was for the child. But across the country, what has happened is it's enabled a number of children to be adopted who would still be in foster care, to the point that the adoption assistance payments and the number of children in adoption assistance now is almost equal to the number of children who are in foster care. But that was the incentive behind it. It's not means tested. In fact, the agency is required to discuss with the adoptive family, and often these adoptive families are the relatives of the foster family who has been caring for the child. About 60% of those are. We are required to discuss with them the fact that this is available, that the federal government does make this funding available. Some families choose not to have it, and it is attached to the child's description as a special needs child. So that if you had, for example, we don't have a lot of infants, healthy infants in our system. Many of the infants we serve come in from methamphetamine families. But if we had a healthy infant, that child would not qualify for an adoption assistance payment. So it's for sibling groups of children. We sometimes place as many as 6 children at a time. The family cannot absorb that cost. One of the things we have looked at during this past session at the request of Chair Richardson are what are some of those options that the state might look at to try to build any kind of containment we can around this particular issue. Some states have gone to means testing, meaning income testing, for those children who are supported entirely by state funds, but they're not allowed to apply that if the funding is through federal match.
Thank you.
I'll continue. The next item, item number 7, is related to staffing costs associated with the substitute care program increases. Also in the narrative there is a description of the other program caseloads for which Children's, Adults, and Families does the eligibility. The department will be asking for the staffing related to the foster care-related increases, but will not ask for staff related to food stamp and medical changes.
Question?
And excuse me.
The staffing study that was, it's kind of ongoing in phase two, but it's being done by Public Knowledge. Have they looked as one of the areas that they focused on, this area of staffing for foster care caseloads report?
Chair Richardson, no, this is not a category yet that has been looked at.
Okay. Before we're done, I'd like to get a comment from the director or for someone on the recommendation that has been made already from that the staffing study that was performed by Pacific Knowledge relating to funds that they thought, you know, percentages that could be saved, and just whether or not there's any movement in that regard. But we can do that later on, whenever you like.
Item number 8 is related to the department's been in negotiations with the Food and Nutrition Services related to the food stamp penalty as a result of the food stamp error rate. And at this juncture, the department is recognizing about $400,000 of the $800,000 penalty for federal fiscal year 04. The department's been in negotiations with FNS, and if the department can bring its error rate below the national average, we wouldn't incur the other $400,000.
That's come up before. What is the trend for us on the error rate?
Overall, the error rate trend is improving for us. It's really going to become an issue of, does the national trend, you know, move faster than we're moving in terms of improvement? That's always an issue.
The task force would really hope that this becomes a priority, in that nobody wants to throw away $800,000 or $400,000. This is money that could have been used for something else. It's like paying a fine. You know, we'd rather avoid it. And
Chair Richardson, this has been a priority, and work is being done to assure that we don't pay penalties, and we're working and have made substantive progress in the last year in reducing the error rate, and would be happy to have individuals come talk about that in more detail than I'm prepared to.
Okay. Ripson Hansen and Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From what I've heard, I'm very pleased that the error rate is going down, and significant progress has been made. One of my concerns and worries is in terms of the $4 million in administrative savings that you've identified, if any of that would relate to cuts that might impede our progress on reducing the error rate.
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, when we looked at that $4 million, we looked at it very carefully to try and be certain about a couple of things. First off, we are not looking at any vacancy savings that relate to the sort of direct service provision through the department, where we would put people at risk, such as employees at the state hospital or our child protective service workers. That was the first decision point. You know, the next point was to look at, were there some places where we could create some savings, understanding that any time that one does that, that there are things that won't get done or issues that will be addressed in a less than timely manner. And, you know, our responsibility is to try and look at those in the most creative way, and to try and look at ways that it's not going to impede our service. And that's our goal, is to try and do that, and hopefully we'll reach that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand the error rate, and very briefly, I presume that the error rate is something different than a misuse of food stamps. And if either or both of you could help me to understand what the majority of the error rate is composed of. People are being issued food stamps that don't qualify. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. Let's get someone who can speak with the most knowledge. Even know who he was. Jim Neely.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director. The error rate in the food stamp program, what we're specifically talking about here, relates to what the federal government calls a payment error rate, or payments made in error. And it's comprised both of overpayments and underpayments to clients. So as we go through the eligibility process, take a look at their income, household size, expenses, all that goes into the mix in terms of what their food stamp benefit amount should be. So whether or not they either misrepresent or we miscalculate what that is, upper or lower than it should be, that becomes the payment error rate.
Okay.
Where we've made tremendous strides in bringing down our payment error rate in the state in the last 3 years, and we're cautiously optimistic now that we will not only be out of penalty, but even very close to the national average, and that is kind of the break point for food nutrition service or the food stamp penalty amount.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Jim, do you have, just to give a sense of, can you quantify the improvement in a little bit? Because I know it has been substantive, and I don't know if you have some way of kind of quantifying that, I think, to give the committee a sense of where we came from and where we are now in terms of that.
We've gone from an error rate in the 13% range, and we're closing in on 6% now.
Okay, that's substantial. Thank you. Oh, Ripley Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you leave, you might want to stick up for the next question. I know that Oregon has had a policy of trying to let potential recipients of food stamps know about the program, and to make certain that those who are qualified are more likely to apply. I wondered the extent to which that has led to increased utilization over the last several years, and to the extent that may have had any influence at all on the error rate as that program has gone forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's an excellent point. Many of the states that have managed to have very low error rates have been very careful about any sort of outreach and they let in the door. Because of Oregon's number one ranking in the hunger arena, I think we've made great efforts to make the food stamp program more accessible, and probably in the last 6 years, the food stamp population in Oregon has doubled. We're about 200 and I think close to 240,000 households in Oregon now, and we distribute nearly $40 million a month in federal food stamp benefits in the state. Anytime we load that many new people into the system, it taxes our ability both to keep up and to do it accurately, and we're working with pretty old information systems to aid us in that regard. So, frankly, I think our error reduction has been even more remarkable in the light of the fact that the program has grown so rapidly over the last few years.
Mr. Chair, follow up on that point.
Did you have a follow up before?
This is I think a very important area for state policy. As you pointed out, the Oregon has been known as having a very high hunger rate, and so dealing with this issue is a very important issue for our citizens. It's my understanding, and I haven't been on the Health Committee since 2001, and I've never been on Ways and Means, so some of this is an issue of first impression for me. My understanding is that the federal government pays the entire cost of food stamps, and that our involvement is in the process of qualification and administration. In other words, in our budget, we don't actually have any money for food stamps. That all comes from the federal government. Have I understood that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. Program dollars, excuse me, are 100% federal dollars, and we split the administrative cost about 50-50 with the federal government.
Oh, so they pay part of that, too?
Yes, they pay about half of it.
Thank you.
Okay, there's one final question. We're going to kind of move on because we're on page 3 of 10 pages, and that's Representative Thatcher. Did you have? Oh, excuse me. Representative Dalto had one, and then Representative Thatcher had a question about residency requirements.
No. My question was about caseload, but I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay, while we're still dealing with food stamps, is there a residency requirement on food stamps? Is that the question?
Mr. Chair, when you say residency, you mean Oregon residency or citizenship?
I guess it's, we're talking about eligibility, and which would include both of those.
Mr. Chair, the food stamp program rules, unlike many of our other programs, are very prescriptive federally. The state has very little to say about the puts and takes of the rules. To get food stamps in Oregon, you need to either be a resident of Oregon or intend to remain here. Food stamp program tends to be more restrictive more restrictive than other programs in terms of citizenship requirements, so that non-citizens who come here and gain citizenship in most cases won't be eligible for food stamps for 7 years unless there are some other specific circumstances. So, and undocumented individuals are not eligible for food stamps.
Okay, we'll get back to this later on today, but you made an interesting comment when you said that food stamps seem to be more restrictive than other programs, which implies that other programs are obviously less restrictive for illegal aliens in the state of Oregon. So we will be dealing with that later on to get a better understanding of that. Other questions? If not, we'll proceed with your presentation.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, just to clarify that. I make a difference, a distinction between non-citizens and undocumented.
Okay.
Because program eligibility is different among different programs. Most programs do not allow services to undocumented aliens.
Okay.
There's just a handful of exceptions there.
So, like, non-citizen would be people that are like green card holders?
Refugee, other immigrant status.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Item 9 on page 3 is related to vocational rehabilitation caseloads, an increase in both the caseload estimate and a slight increase in the overall cost per case, about $1 million general fund issue. Item 10 is related to the $4 million department-wide administrative savings that Bruce talked about, and that's about $1.3 million, $1.4 million for children, adults, and families. On page 4, we move to the seniors and peoples with disabilities. The overall projected need within this cluster is about $21 million general fund. Again, the first two items, the first item is related to the Medicaid match rate change of $9 million impact for the seniors and people with disabilities cluster. And the second item is related to the roll-up issues from 0305, about a $13 million issue. Item 3 is related to increase estimated caseloads within the developmental disabilities in the long-term diversion area. Department really began to see this late in the 0305 biennium, and this is adjusting for that increase. It's offset slightly by an increase in Medicaid eligible participation areas within the DD area, and that saves about $500,000, so it brings it to about a 4.4 general fund need. Item 4 is related to the nursing facility caseloads. Overall, slightly up, about 25 cases, and a slightly higher cost per case, about a 2.6 general fund need. Item 5 is related to the in-home care worker program. Overall, the expenditures are expected to be less by $1.4 million. It's made up of really three different areas. The collective bargaining agreement original estimate for the increased cost associated with that was $10 million. The revised estimates that have been developed indicate that would actually be about an $8.2 million cost. And that's, you can see that the components of that is $3.7 million related to training, $900,000 related to dental insurance, $3.6 million related to wage increases, and a small mileage reimbursement increase. The second piece, within the home care worker program is a $10.5 million savings related to slightly lower caseloads and costs of about $1.4 million, and overall lower health insurance benefit costs of about $8.1 million. This is offset slightly by about $900,000 in increased need related to lower expected client contribution revenues as a result of the Medicare Modernization Act copayment issues. Item 6 is related to other in-home care services caseloads. Caseloads are lower by 220 cases. And cost per case is higher by about $45 per case, and that's about a $900,000 issue. Item 7, the Oregon supplemental income caseload estimates are lower by about $3,700, and this results in a caseload savings or a dollar savings of $2.9 million. Item number 8, which is the overall community facilities expenditures. Total caseloads are lower by 135 cases, as also has a cost per case overall lower estimate of $19. And again, client contribution revenues are lower. And finally, the program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, referred to as PACE, had a lowering of its composite rate that results in a $1.7 million general fund savings, and that's really also the result of the Medicare modernization drug impacts. Item 9 is related to the $4 million department-wide administrative savings. That's about $1.3 million related within seniors and people with disabilities. Page 6 moves to the health services cluster. Within this cluster, the overall additional need is estimated at $114 million general fund. Again, item 1 is related to the federal match rate. That's a $13 million general fund impact for the health services cluster. Item 2 is related to the roll-up issues. Of $3.4 million impact. Item 3 is related to the revised caseload estimates Bruce talked about earlier, and that's the roughly $88 million projected estimated impact there.
I have a question on that for the director, and that is, and we've had conversation about the lower caseload estimates for the TANF as far as what is indicated in the fall forecast and what we actually have had in the last 6 or 8 months in of actual caseload. And then there's other areas like aid to the blind and disabled that may be even higher than what the forecast. There were some of the categories were lower and some were higher. What do you see as far as the trends are concerned? Do you think that based on actual caseloads that it's likely that we're going to reach the level that has been forecast in the fall forecast, or do you think that it may be more or less?
Chair Richardson, I think you're asking the question that's on all of our minds and the question that we need to know. And let me answer that in a couple of ways, because I think that there's a couple of issues involved. The first, I think, is just to understand that at any point in time, we're making a projection based on what's going to happen in the next year and a half, which is can be affected by any one of a number of external and environmental factors, programmatic changes, changes in federal policy, et cetera. So I think that, you know, I'm being cautious more because I think that everybody wants a number. And I don't think that we can, I can't sit up here and provide today a number of, with 100% accuracy of where we're going to be a year and a half from now. As we've discussed, we can do a very good job of being very clear about what the caseloads are going to be in February of 2006. I think we can predict with tremendous accuracy caseloads in February of 2006. February of 2007, the degree of accuracy starts to change, and February of 2008, the degree of accuracy starts to change. I'm not saying that in any way to try and minimize the need to be as accurate as possible. We need to be. I just think we need to understand the context of this. And what we need to do is, as we develop forecasts, and I'll jump ahead to some of the things that we're doing to ensure some of this, and get back to the answer to your question, is what we need to do is, as we do these forecasts and improve the accuracy and validity of them, understand that it's not a one-time endeavor where we wait every 6 months for some sort of news. I think what we need to do, and what we've discussed, is to be able to look at a forecast, and then every month how the actual experience is tracking against what is a prediction, and be able to look at is the actual experience tracking with the forecast. You need to know that as for budget and policy purposes. We need to do that within the agency to be able to examine why or why not something is or isn't tracking with what was a prediction.
Okay, well, now, just to kind of summarize what you're saying that we have two issues. One is the we need to improve reliability, mm-hmm. and lessen volatility.
Correct.
And one of the steps that you're taking is that you're going to look at more recent data and more frequently rather than just every 6 months say, guess what, here's where you're at for the new forecast.
Correct. We need to do a couple of things. The validity piece, we need to look at one issue is around forecasting, looking at our process and having another set of eyes which provides the accountability and, in essence, a validity check on what we're doing. And we can talk about the forecasting process, but one of the things that we will be doing is I've already been in discussions with Das and Lindsay Ball, and we've had a discussion about, as I think everybody knows, should we maintain the forecasting function within DHS, or would we improve the validity and reliability by moving it elsewhere and have someone else do that? And we've taken in the last month a long and hard look at that. And
have you reached a conclusion?
Yes, we have reached a conclusion, and the conclusion is this: that I think we need both. The best of both worlds. One is that what we clearly understand is that these forecasts are based around a variety of issues. One is historical trends. Two is understanding programs and behaviors and what's happening in the field, what's happening programmatically, what's happening in the environment. And so there needs to be a connection between those people who are doing the forecasting around each of these programs. They need to have that information and be understand and have a rich understanding of those programs. So I think there needs to be they need to remain within DHS, not within the programs themselves, separate from the programs where they are now, but to be within the department to maintain that connection. I think as you've walked through each of these budget lines, you've gotten an understanding of the complexity of a variety of the programs, each of which affect these forecasts in a variety of ways and what's happening. We also have an external review group that's comprised of individuals from LFO, BAM, as well as some experts from outside of government to help provide some input into that forecasting process. We need to have that continue. And then once we create a forecast, what we've been discussing is then before that forecast is finalized, actually having it then go to DAS and individuals within DAS who have expertise with forecasting to provide, in essence, an audit and a validity and a reliability check as to that forecast.
Okay, I want to ask a quick question,
sure,
from Representative Dalto,
mm-hmm,
and that is, have you looked at other states? What is the benchmark? How does Oregon's forecasting compare with other states?
We can have Judy Moore Peterson come and provide you with some information. We've been looking at other states, how we compare, other states' processes in terms of how other states do the forecasting. There's a variety of methods and how things are done, and we're looking at all of that.
Rather than waiting and dealing with forecasting as a separate issue, it's inherent,
sure,
to what we're doing. So
yeah,
why don't we have...
While Judy's coming up, so, I mean, because let me get to... The you started with really you wanted to know how do we compare, how are we tracking, and you know, are we going to see greater than anticipated caseloads or less? And I started us off talking about the whole forecasting process because I think it's important, and I'll turn that over to Judy. We're looking at those month by month actuals, and in many of the caseload areas are finding that we're tracking fairly close to the recent forecast. There are a couple of areas where we are tracking a little bit lower and a couple of areas that we're tracking a little bit above. When we look at the aged, blind, and disabled, and we look at the TANF group, we, and Judy, correct me if I'm wrong, we're tracking slightly below in the aged, blind, and disabled. And I say slightly because I don't, these are trends, and that can change. And that suddenly being just below the line can move above the line, but I think we've got some indication that we're slightly below the line.
Actually, I could be good because yeah, in the actual figures that I've got for April, May, and June of last year, it was slightly above. But if we're tracking now down, then that means that we may have peaked.
We don't know. I wouldn't say peaked because there isn't a peak in that line. That line is a slow and steady increase, mm-hmm, and I don't think that line is going to peak until all of the baby boomers have peaked. Well, some of us have peaked. But
we peaked a long time ago, actually.
Well, in our minds, we're still going strong. The issue is, I think that the line may be, we may see the line be reset a little bit lower. That's exactly it. Not as steep. It will continue to increase, just not as steep a slope. In the TANF group, we are seeing some decrease in the caseloads as well. Whether that's an area where we may have peaked or not, we don't know. But I think the biggest issue, and I think that what's coming out of all of this is an understanding by all of us, legislators, policymakers, as well as the agency, that you know, these are very serious issues, and they deserve the kinds of scrutiny that we're all paying to them now. And what I'm seeing is a change in the way we look at, respond to, analyze all of these, which will help strengthen our programs. You know, as I mentioned yesterday, I asked that each of the caucus leaders, the four caucus leaders, to nominate an individual. We're putting together a group of four legislators, one from each of the four caucuses, and representatives from LFO and BAM. It's
Legislative and Fiscal Office.
Legislative Fiscal Office and the BAM, which is the Budget
and
Management. Office.
The governor's
right.
area.
Within the Department of Administrative Services, we're going to forming a group to meet every 4 to 6 weeks to do exactly what we're starting to discuss now in its abstract, but to do it with the actual numbers and to be able to sit down every month, look at what the forecasts have shown, what the actuals are, to look at where we're heading, why we're heading in that direction, or why we're not heading in a direction we want to go to, so that we can all have a better understanding of this. You opened the hearing by indicating that part of the frustration is the fluctuation, and suddenly you create a budget, and then 6 months later we find out, wait a minute, that's not correct. And I don't think that's the way any of us would manage our finances, that we would make a budget and then not check it for 6 months and then suddenly find out where we are. We need to look at this in the caseload forecasting month by month. We need to look at improving the reliability and validity of it. And I think that we can do that. And we've begun that process. And I'm confident that it will improve this for everybody. Will it be 100% accurate? I don't think anybody can guarantee to predict the future with 100% accuracy. What I can guarantee is that we will continue to work at putting the kinds of improvements in the way we do things to make it more accurate and to look at increasing the frequency at which we do these forecasts, look at the processes by which we do them, be certain we're getting the right input and expertise involved in the process.
You know, I'd like to stop you right there for a second, because process is, you know, you've gone into frequency review, external review group, so we get people looking at it, but it's the process that is an issue as far as I'm concerned. In looking at how the spring forecast was obtained, which is the one that we used in the legislature in the last session to develop a budget, a primary factor in it was the caseload that existed between March and September of 2004. And so here we are in the middle of the second quarter of 2005, reaching that. And then we developed a budget based on, to a large extent, on those caseloads. And then in October, we get a fall forecast, which was based to a large extent on the caseloads from October of 2004 through March of 2005.
That's correct.
And yet we're in a time of, we're pulling out of a recession, and yet the indications from the case from the forecast would not reflect that at all. And so what is taking place in the process? You know, what help do you need from the legislature or assistance from IT so that the process could change so that you can use more immediate real life figures than being two quarters of stale figures that you're using as a major portion of the forecast?
Richardson, I think those are the issues that we're looking at and trying. I can't come before you and say we need one, two, and three. I think that as we are looking at this, as we put together this group, as we work with DAS, as we do this, we'll have a better sense of what it is we may need to be able to do that. I don't know of a particular item that we need, I think we need to look, we need to do exactly what we're doing, which is look at the process. If we're going to do it more frequently, I don't know whether we need more personnel to help do some of the physical tasks in terms of the cleaning of the information. And I think those are some of the questions that we're looking at and we'll look at over the next couple of months.
I think those are had the opportunity to spend the time that I have with you and with Judy Moore Peterson. So would you take a moment and, Ms. Peterson, and tell us how what the process is now? I mean, what you're the head forecaster. Is that correct? So you're the one. Of course, I need to mention that you've been on the job here for 2 weeks longer than the director, right?
Right.
And okay, well,
and I'm comforted that she's still here. I'm following right behind her.
We appreciate the longevity of you being in your post. Turnover, you know, this is good.
And I appreciate the discussion and know that we're all in this to make it to look at making this better, and that's what we need to do.
For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I'm the manager for the Client Caseload Forecasting Unit. I actually have a team of three forecasters who work for me who do the forecasts for each different cluster area. So I'm actually not the head forecaster, as Chair Richardson pointed out. Now, are you asking what the present process is or what it has been? Our particular unit has been in existence as a centralized unit for just over a year. So we actually don't have a long history of experience in conducting the forecasts for the entire department.
Okay, so you're saying before that, each of the areas had their
areas,
own forecasting.
Right, would work through their own process, et cetera.
And let me just interject. I think that was an important step in terms of reliability and validity was moving as I indicated, forecasting needs to be connected to programs, but if it's embedded in programs, it often may have a bias and a lack of an external look at some of this that's required. So that was done with intent, was to move the individual forecasting pieces out from the programs but still remain within the department to understand what's going on.
Well, that's one of the reasons I think that we're not really pressing at this time for forecasting to be moved to DAS, because if you merely take the same people and the same processes and move them into a new agency, you've essentially transferred them. You're going to keep getting what you've been getting, but with a different letterhead.
Right.
But by having it be in your administration aspect of DHS, and the real focus needs to be on what can be done to make it more accurate and less volatile.
So did you like me to walk
a brief idea of what goes into a forecast?
Okay. Okay. First of all, the forecasters meet with the program areas, and there's kind of a decision or an agreement made on what the populations are going to be that are going to be forecast, because you could categorize them in a variety of different ways, and the data that's maybe available to do the forecast is highly variable within the department. So walking through some of those first steps,
do you honor the
coming
information
to an agreement
that you're given, or do you just accept the information that comes from district offices and you plug it in?
There's, I think, over 50 different payment systems and at least three major client tracking systems for hundreds of different program areas within the department.
Because what I'm asking is, how do you assure that the data that you're using is accurate?
That you can do some reliability checks on whether the data itself is within range and taking a look at it that way. Also, within the different program areas, they also have they may have some monthly reports that categorize the clients or case counts, et cetera, and you can look for sort of data anomalies, large fluctuations between what we have and what's collected from it. Some of the data we actually go out and pull into our centralized data system, and in other data systems they send us the data. It's dependent upon the each program area.
Okay, hold on just for a moment. Representative Hansen, did you have a question on this
not,
line?
Not yet.
Okay. Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, this shortfall we have, and you're basing that on information you're getting from the different areas of the state, can we identify a certain area that was the biggest problem? Was there a geographic area? Was it, you know, the valley? Was it eastern Oregon? Was it urban? You know, where were the mistakes made? Was it all universal across the board? Or was there certain, cities, areas that you could identify?
No tsunami on the coast, and so it's not. How do you identify?
Chair Richardson, Representative Wisnert, the data isn't coming from the various. It's a statewide data systems. So it's a collection of all the data from throughout all the programs that DHS is serving, that statewide, and then that's all pulled together and aggregated into. Summed up and aggregated it pulled into large data sets that aren't divided up by each different geographical area. So we're not doing the forecast based on the different regions of the state. It's all pulled up together. It's based on the different program areas and that variation between what the estimations were for the spring versus the fall. That's where the changes come about.
Okay.
The particular program area.
Chair, I understand that, but still, that data came from cities, counties, or whatever, and can you trace back to find out where the big problems were?
The question really is there a geographical area that is driving the caseload up, or is it statewide?
It's statewide.
And I think the other question is about, it's not just is it a particular area, but what were the assumptions? What is this about data or some of the assumptions? Is it that, there's a difference between the spring and the fall forecast. And I think what you're getting at is why is there that difference? Is it suddenly there are, we thought there were more people in a particular geographic area. I think the answer to that is no, that the forecast in the spring was lower than it turns out it is. And the question is, why is that? And there's two different population groups, primarily in the Oregon Health Plan, that it was. Maybe you could talk a little bit about each one. Is that what you'd...
Yeah, thanks.
Just follow up.
Mr. Chair, now just comments to you. I was not sure, if we're here to help the DHS do their job, we got to first identify where the problem was.
Yeah.
We can't, get a handle on DHS and change or reorganize DHS. We've got to find out where the problem was. If it's strictly in forecasting, that's where we need to focus and see, was it data that came from up or down, or where did this, problem come? That's where I think we need to focus, and that's my comment to you and suggestion to you. But we'll go on. I know we got a lot of data to cover. I'm sorry.
Sure. Rips and golf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I am not convinced that it's completely a forecasting problem. I mean, we were just, my colleague and I were discussing the nature of this concept of people shifting between what they're eligible for, and the example that I was thinking and I wanted to ask the director was this question of, how people get from the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program into the Oregon Health Plan Plus Program, because that's going to be the real driver of increased, caseload demand. And so one of the questions I had was, you have somebody that's eligible for Oregon Health Plan Standard. We have no more slots except for, what's provided for by the provider tax. 24,000 slots. How do they move? What is the scenario under which they move from the standard to the plus population? And one theory, I guess that I had was through eligibility for TANF, and we discussed this a little bit before. And so, do you have a situation where you have a mom who's just above the line for Oregon Health Plan Plus, and they were receiving standard benefits, no longer eligible, so then they move into the PLUS program because of eligibility, some subsequent eligibility for either food stamps or TANF benefits?
Judy, this is Chair Richardson, Representative Dalto, this is one of the, you're talking about what the drivers around the TANF increase. And this is exactly what we're looking at, is to why that happened. And I think it's due to a number of factors related to both OHP standard, related to the way the TANF program is structured. And let me have Judy walk you through a little bit of that, because this is what we've been focusing on and can, at whatever point, we've got a lot of information, we don't have it in front of us, but can walk people through what's happened within the TANF population as both there's been changes in the economy and as OHP standard has changed. Both of those factors have led to an increase in the TANF population.
And Mr. Chair, before she gets started, let me also phrase the question in a different way. You have, if I may, Mr. Chair,
certainly.
You have different categories that make somebody categorically eligible for Oregon Health Plans Plus. So do we know them? Can we track individually within those categories how the demand has gone up? For example, I don't imagine that the number of profoundly disabled or blind or that category is going to go up. And I don't imagine that the number of children eligible is going to go up simply because that's not growing fast. So you'll be able to tell us, won't you? In terms of those other categories that make you categorically eligible.
Yes. No, I mean one issue. I mean, but the CHIP population has seen the greatest growth. You had indicated the number of kids really hasn't been changing. Quite frankly, we talked about the aged, blind, and disabled, and the TANF group as being the biggest budget drivers. They are. But in terms of percentage increase, the biggest percentage increase have been in CHIP kids. They're not driving the budget because the expenses are much less. Fortunately, most children are healthy, and so the expenditures are not as great. But I believe there was a 25% increase in the number of kids in CHIP over what we had predicted. That's primarily due to, we believe, a number of factors. Increased outreach in the FEOP program and amongst many people in the community to try and enroll kids in the CHIP program. Directly relates to then what happens. So some of it is actually external to what goes on in the department. They're external factors. To get at the TANF question, Judy.
What's there left to say?
Some of us, by the way, are working on a little plan to deal with kids.
Yeah.
To take some of the pressure off.
I'd like to, before we get into a long answer, because this is your question kind of has evolved into something that I think is very fundamental to the purpose of our meeting here today. During the session, when we're working on budgets, we eliminated general assistance. I lost sleep, over worrying about the poorest in Oregon because they're going to be just cut off. And it wasn't a lot of money, but when you don't have anything, anything is a lot. And then I find out after the fall forecast comes out that they were presumptively determined eligible for the OHP and moved en masse to the aid for the blind and disabled. And I never knew this, and I was the head of the subcommittee on the budget for those programs. Is there any presumptive movement? Has there been a decision specifically made to provide those who have been in standard who are no longer there to become eligible for the plus? We're talking about the Oregon Health Plan Plus.
Representative Richardson, yes and no. There has not been a major movement directly from OHP standard to the OHP plus populations. However, if we take a look at the overall Oregon Health Plan population, and we look at the timing of when those increases have taken place and in what programs have taken place, they've corresponded with major program changes and major decisions that the state has made on serving the Oregon Health Health Plan population.
Okay, start with program changes. Because I thought that we were controlled by weight.
Closing of the OHP's, creating the OHP standard benefit package. That's a major program change. The elimination of general assistance in the way that that program was run, but continuing with the medical assistance portion of that, that's a major program change. The elimination of the medically needy program, that's another major program change. Those have taken place in the last 2-year time period. And those have ramifications and have impacts that ripple through all of the caseloads. And that is in large part what we are seeing. And that is also what makes it very, very difficult to predict what's going to happen 2 years from now or 3 years from now. Because we don't have kind of recent historical experience on what those impacts might be. And when we have our discussions, the people who get together to talk about it, they bring their best thinking and think, well, this is what we think is going to happen, or this is how long we think those impacts are going to be. But we don't really know. Earlier on, you asked, well, what's the effects of what's going on nationally with other states? There's quite a range in how other states do their caseload forecasting. We're right in the mix on how we do it. As far as the overall accuracy rates, how those tend to be calculated, there is a tremendous range. Sometimes some programs are as much as plus or minus 8%. On average, it tends to be plus or minus 4%. And when we look at those other states, when they've had the most difficulty, in other words, predicting, is when they've had the most number of recent program changes. So we're kind of not unusual in that. It's unfortunate, but we're not unusual in the sense that it's difficult to predict. When you go through major transitions like that, it's very difficult to then predict how long they're going to last, the magnitude of the effects, and how they're going to play out in the other caseloads.
Okay. Director?
I think Representative Galto's question can illustrate some of what happens when you do a program change and how that happens. And I believe what he was referring to is when we ended allowing new individuals to come onto OHP standard, there had been individuals who could qualify to be on the Oregon Health Plan through a number of different programs. You could have qualified by being TANF eligible. You could have also just come in through Oregon Health Plan standard. And indeed, what we're seeing today is that there are individuals who, because no longer is there an ability to come onto the health plan through Oregon Health Plan standard, some of these individuals qualify for OHP Plus. They always have. There never was any reason for either those individuals or their caseworkers to look at that. Because it was only one benefit, and that was it. We're required, when people come into our offices, to screen them, look at their eligibility, and if indeed they do qualify for Oregon Health Plan Plus by being eligible for TANF, they come on to that. And that's an example of how program changes will change how eligibility patterns are, and I think it's indicative of some of the complexity of what happens in terms of when there's a program change, what the effects of that are over the next year or two. And sometimes we understand that, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we should have understood it better than we did, and that's one example of that.
Okay. asking, has there been an overt decision to transfer any portion of standard population people into the Oregon Health Plan Plus population? Has there been a lessening or a change in the eligibility requirements?
Chair Richardson, no. There's been no change. So there was no overt decision to say, okay, now you're going to qualify for OHP Plus.
Okay, you know, the reason I bring it up is we have a program which is aid to the blind and the disabled, and that program assumed all the people that were in general assistance. And so, and I'm not saying that that wasn't a good move. I don't know. I haven't looked at it. But it was a decision that was made to provide benefits for a population in a plan where that plan, you know, the program was being terminated, and it wasn't widely known, and it wasn't brought up to this.
Chair Richardson, before those individuals could be, the general assistance clients could be disqualified, they needed to be given the opportunity to declare whether they had a disability or not. And from my understanding, that was based on federal regulations. And so that it was not a decision on the department's case to just transfer those individuals to the aid to the blind or aid to the disabled categories. It was indeed relative to those individuals' disability status while we were evaluating their disability.
Okay, thank you.
And they had to qualify for the aid to the disabled category. They weren't.
They had independently qualified.
Right.
It wasn't a change in eligibility.
Correct.
No. Okay, got it. Ripson and Hansen.
Well, first of all, I think in the Ways and Means process, we discussed quite a bit the presumptive eligibility for general assistance clients.
We discussed eligibility. I remember that, but I did not know that the entire population was just being moved over because we had people that came in and saying, what are you going to do? These are the poorest of the poor, and how are you going to help them? And no, it said, by the way, it's all being moved. So,
I question some of the budget projections in terms of the savings of cutting general assistance. It was originally presented to us as a $14 million savings, and I think by the end of our discussions it was down much less than that because of the presumptive eligibility issue. People are eligible at different levels for different programs. And when one program goes away, I've worked with some of my constituents that have called and said, you know, I'm losing this benefit, and I make phone calls and stuff and find out what other programs they might be eligible for as a substitution for. I think that, and I think any case manager that's worth their salt, if somebody is being removed from a program but are eligible for a different program or there's a different way for them to get the benefits, I mean, that's the absolute obligation of a case manager to try and get the maximum benefits for the people that they're serving. And obviously this is a dynamic that occurs when we change programs. It's just that in this particular case, we didn't factor it in ahead of time. One of the things I'm concerned with, though, is in terms of what we're really focusing on, is this a budgeting problem? Is it a forecasting problem? Or is it a program problem? And there's probably elements of all of it, but as I see the forecasting problem, as you correctly identified, is especially with two-year bienniums, that we're using relatively stale numbers in order to project 2 years into the future. And I think the one area that we can dramatically improve is by having the most current up-to-date figures. I mean, mm-hmm. I would think the director, it'd be well within your ability to know how many intakes DHS, how many intake interviews DHS provided in December. That every branch knows that, and if those are 13% higher than they were a year ago, or 8% higher, we realize that we may not be able to identify program by program every dollar that those people are going to need, but there's going to be an indication that there's going to be some unmet budgeting needs if we're projecting a 6% increase and our actual numbers are 13%.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly some of the ways we need as an agency to start to be more proactive in how we look at and follow trends. And some of that is forecasting and following the numbers. Some of that is looking at some of the other indicators out that we can have available to us to get a sense of that. If the numbers of people coming into offices is higher, then it would stand to reason that caseloads may go up. Exactly where and whether we can determine which populations and how much dollars to allocate to that becomes a different story. But I think this is about doing exactly those types of things.
And at that point, then that early warning might trigger some other research into terms of whether it's seniors and disabled or food stamp intakes, right, or whatever. One of the things that I'm very aware of too is my wife is former TANF case manager and a former food stamp manager. A lot of people that would apply for food stamps didn't really want the food stamp benefit. It was based on their income and stuff, it was a relatively small benefit. Basically, they were going through the process in order to qualify for the Oregon Health Plan and to get accepted into the Oregon Health Plan. And I think that's something that I sense is a real driver of health coverage, which is so incredibly valuable and so devastating to families or people if they don't have it, are going to explore every opportunity in order to get the care. And where maybe in the past they could work in a relatively underemployed situation, have the Oregon Standard card in their pocket, and decide, no, I really don't need TANF benefits, or I really don't need food stamp benefits. But when that health card disappears and they have left the system, lost a job maybe that had health benefits and stuff, they're going to start to explore a lot of other issues or other avenues to get that same level of coverage.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Goldberg, the line of questioning has kind of been around, if we can find the problem, we can find the solution. And
right.
I just want to return to some of your earlier comments. You said that the bulk of your shortfall, 70% is what I figured it was,
yes,
to caseload and cost per case increases. And you said especially as relate to the Oregon Health Plan.
87.99.
I'm wondering if your experience in the public sector is anything akin to what I and others in the private sector have experienced, and that is the cost of medical inflation being so great that it has outstripped our ability to forecast. I would share with you, if I might, Mr. Chairman, I would share with you the example that I deal with virtually on a daily basis as a union representative talking to both labor and management. We have some of the largest private sector health trusts, the largest in the state. Every time our plans, the money that's allocated, is exceeded by inflation, somebody pays for that. It's either the employer, the employees, or both. And we have a whole lot of unhappy people because of that. Every single instance. Because unhappy people cause representation questions for the union, and those costs also represent dollars out of the pocket for the employer, we have every incentive to find the very best forecasters that we can. They have, each and every one of them, been wrong. And I am just asking you, is medical inflation that's out of control in this country, what extent is that a problem?
Chair Richardson, Representative Witt, you've hit on certainly one of the problems, and everybody is looking for one particular, what's the one problem. It's a variety of issues, and indeed, as you've indicated, what goes on in our programs is just a reflection of what's going on systemically, and certainly we're looking at increased need on the Oregon Health Plan. Certainly the affordability of health care out in the community is a huge issue and certainly affects this. And we all know that health care costs are increasing. The costs of that insured individuals are paying in terms of premiums and copays is increasing. The ability of low-income families to afford family coverage, even when offered by their employer, has diminished. And as an example of that is the issue I've been pointing to all along. If you look at the last several years in this state, we have not, on the public side, cut health coverage to children. In fact, over the last 5 years, we've expanded eligibility and public coverage. We have more kids on the Oregon Health Plan than before. Despite that, we have seen increases in the number of children that are uninsured, and you know, the cause and effect, there's a lot of factors about that. One of the issues is that, you know, family coverage is becoming increasingly unaffordable for employed families who are working, who can't afford the premiums for family coverage. That's an environmental factor that then comes into the forecasting issue. So, I mean, certainly one of the issues is the affordability of health care. Yeah. And I think we're seeing that.
You said a very important point, and I think we need to clarify. It's not just that it's going up, because it's not going up uniformly everywhere. We had a discussion earlier today. The national average for health care costs is $162 a year per person. That's how much is spent on health care. In Oregon, it's $174 a person a year. In California, it's $132 a year per person. And California is, you know, not exactly known as chintzy. In Colorado, it's $92 a year per person. In Washington, it's $81 a year per person. So Oregon is spending $174, and Washington is $81. Arizona is $81, Utah is $72, and Idaho is $70. Hawaii is $400 and some. And so it's a very broad spectrum of costs for health care per person, per population, or per state. And so one of the things that we can't solve today, but certainly we want to have looked at, is why are we at where we're at, and are the citizens of Oregon getting their money's worth at $174? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you're on that point, I'd like to amplify on that question, if I may. But then I had another question of my own. I looked at the material that you referred to in your email on the website, and I wasn't able to study it with great care, but I was unable to find the definition of what items were included in the study for public health expenses. And I have the suspicion, may not be accurate, that we're comparing apples and oranges, because the states categorize things in different ways, although I don't know that for sure. And that would be something that I think we ought to ask the department to investigate for us looking at it at a different time. I could find no relationship between that expense number that you refer to and the actual outcomes in the states. And logically, there ought to be some relationship between those things if they're actually measuring the same thing. Now, to the question that I had a minute ago, if I may, you know, it sounds to me as though when we do program changes, that we are it's a great difficulty taking into account what's actually going to happen out there in the real world. And I think we've identified, if I understand it correctly, two or three different kinds of things that have happened in the real world that have affected the this budget. One of them is that we have underestimated the extent to which people may be eligible for more than one program. So that when the legislature thinks, hey, we're going to take $14 million out of that program, the reality is that the people in the program may qualify for several programs, and that, in fact, the savings, if any, may be much smaller. In fact, I would argue that, and I see heads nodding here, so I'm going to go on, I would argue that there are situations in which making those changes actually costs us more money because we are processing people more extensively than we might otherwise, and because we discover as we go ahead with deprocessing that they qualify for additional programs that cost us money that they otherwise wouldn't have asked for in the first place. Then the other issue that it seems to me that we've raised is that there have been ongoing changes in the external economy. In this case, the reduction in the availability of health insurance in the private economy, and there are at least some people who come into the Oregon Health Plan through the temporary assistance to needy families and through food stamps, who would never have requested it had Representative Hansen's health card in the pocket rule applied to those people. No longer applies to them because they're no longer covered by private insurance. And of course, it's very difficult to make those predictions. Now, first, I'd like to ask: do you agree with that analysis? Because I've tried to state it in a slightly different way than other people have. And second, are there other factors in addition to those two rather large ones that you think are likely to have be involved in this very large, the large piece of this shortfall that we're discussing?
Chair Richardson, Representative Barnhart, I agree that this is extremely complex and multifactorial, and that there are a lot of factors that influence all of this, and I think that the items you mentioned are certainly amongst those. And you know, the issue before us is to gain a better sense of and knowledge of what happens within these programs, what happens when changes are made, not just as a forecasting issue, but as you indicated, as a budgeting issue as well. And we need to gain greater understanding, all of us collectively from the department and the legislature, and look at this, fix those things that can be fixed, understand those things we need to understand better so we can make informed decisions about what we're doing.
You know, what you've brought up is very important, Representative Barnhart, and it has helped me to add to my list of what are some of the reasons why the forecasting is not accurate. And you're saying, and it, rightly so, that it, I have not been considering the hydraulic effect. Now, you have a population of needy people, and they're served by different programs, and if you cut back on one program, it's like a water balloon, and you're squeezing it in one area. They don't just go away. The needs are still there, and so now it's where can I qualify, and so it'll be paid for, but it'll be paid for under a different program. And so I think it's important as we look at budgeting that we're not merely saying we're cutting back $2 million here, and so we're saving $2 million.
Well, and if I could amplify on that just for a second, you know, if you're an administrator in a program and you have you're a case manager and someone comes in to find out whether they qualify for a program, if there are several different ways of getting onto the program, I think the temptation, and probably realistically, for a case manager would be to go ahead and do the evaluation. When they get the answers they need to qualify you for the program under one of the methods, you're done.
Bingo.
And when that method goes away, because we're no longer funding that program as a legislature, They simply continue asking questions to find out whether people also qualify under some other avenue for getting on the program.
And then the second point is the outreach, the consequences of outreach. We, a couple of years ago, there was a tremendous outreach on signing people up for food stamps because it's a federal program, and it's the feds are even paying half of the cost of administration, and Oregon was high in, you know, number one in hunger, and so, by golly, we're going to do that. Well, the consequences of that outreach in one program can extend to other programs which have budgetary considerations and consequences as well. So,
Mr. Chair, to your first point, if I may.
Representative Balto.
Yeah, I find that, or it seems to me, this issue with the Oregon Health Plan standard versus plus eligibility forecast is wrong because the department probably did the wrong thing in the first place of putting people in the wrong program. I think that a decision probably should have been made earlier on in years past to put people into the Oregon Health Plan Plus program when the eligibility was determined, even if they were, you know, eligible for the standard program. I mean, you have to explain what the benefit mix is like, maybe the differences there. But, you know, you're building a forecast now, and we've built a forecast now, and this $172 million business is built on a forecast that inaccurately people weren't even placed in the right program in the first place. And so it's not that your forecast is wrong. It is your forecast is wrong. The demand was miscalculated initially, and so now you're building on this faulty forecasting model. So that's my first point. And I want to move this discussion along too. And I have a question about your financial services unit, but really, I mean, now the Oregon legislature is being asked to balance this problem the department created in years past because they weren't properly putting people in the right positions. And then you have the whole question about whether the legislature is appropriating general funds to the standard program and how, you know, what the funding the funding basis is for the plus program.
I'm going to, with your leave, everyone, expand this. You know, we can continue with the line item, but then what we've done is we've covered pages, but we can read that ourselves and get answers for specifics. And so what we're talking about as we go through this conversation is getting to the real heart of what the people need to know as to why this has happened and what the components are. And so as we talk about eligibility and movement among programs, it introduces the issue that's been highly discussed lately, and that is of those that do not qualify for program that are on the programs and are getting benefits that they're not eligible for. And one area that has been widely discussed lately is those that are illegally in our state who are receiving benefits for which they're not eligible. And how large of a problem is that in DHS and in the costs that we are incurring?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, can we change the people at the table to get you that information? We're prepared to talk about that. It's a different crew, and some of us need to take a quick break.
Mr. Chair, I need more information on this Judy's office, and I'd like to know if I can get it in paper. I don't need it. I need to know how many people. I don't understand you. This is a one-year organization, and we've been doing this by department. I mean, we're here to talk about forecasting. I'm sorry. I don't take any responsibility for the – I'm proud of the budget. We funded what you told us you wanted funded, and we funded it. It was under – I worked in the government, federal government for 20 years. Yeah. I never under-budgeted. I always asked for more money than and here we've, you know, you've asked for less money than you need. So, I mean, I need to know to make a – to help you, to help the people of Oregon, and help the needy people. You know, what is this this is the organization that told you how much money they needed. It's been in existence for a year. And 2 years ago, we said we were short, and then they found the money. I mean, what's going on here? I mean, I need more. If you don't want to talk about it today, I need more. I need it in writing or something. Judy says she's only been on the job a year. She has five people, and they're doing this, and it's a change dramatic.
I thought it was 11 weeks.
11. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But
do you have
whatever the chair prefers?
Well, it depends on if you have a specific question for them on.
No, I'll be glad to get it in writing or whatever. But I don't understand how we're doing this. I mean, To me, I thought this committee, our problem is finding over $100 million that was due to a forecast shortfall, an error. And that's what Dr. Goldberg says in his documentation, that there was faulty forecasting.
We had a spring forecast which underestimated what the need is. And we've got to look to improve that. We'd be happy to provide you whatever materials you want in writing as an introduction, and also be happy to meet with your representative, Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, because also, I mean, I understand one of the proposals from Dr. Goldberg is to have a CFO. I mean, how can we justify that? Is that a solution? I mean, are we going to create another bureaucracy or another state employee? Is that really going to help it? Can, you know, we have an organization supposed to be doing forecasting, but it's not. I mean, I need to. Are we going to? We're going to talk about the health costs in Oregon, and that's another subject. But if we're going to try to figure out this forecast issue and problem,
the difficulty is that it has multifacets, and people here have different backgrounds in it. I've gone through all the manuals and all the forecasts, and the conclusion that I've come with, and I'd like to have you address before we go this, is that the numbers, the primary driving factor were the averages of caseload. For instance, on TANF, the period of the caseload growth between March of 04 and September of 04 was fairly flat. And so we have a spring forecast, which also is flat, and that's on page 20 of the manual here, the Medical Assistance Program Fall 05 forecast. And that graph shows a forecast for the fall, or the spring forecast that we built a budget on, and we built a budget that was less than, I said TANF, I meant the foster, just as an example, the foster care. It was flat, and so we had a flat forecast in the spring, and then it resumed in the months that followed September of 04, the upward trend that it had been having for years, and so the fall forecast was followed that average forecast for the six-month period that was after that in this one instance, and so what we ended up having is an underfunded program as of the spring, based on the spring forecast, and now we have a shortfall based on the fall forecast. And so the huge driver in this, you know, there's three components. One is that we had problems with revenue and some allocations, and we dealt with that in the October e-board, and that was $30 million. We had the reduction in the match rate from the federal government, which will start October 1st of next year, and that's $26 or $28 million, just a 0.5% change there. And the rest, $119.2 million, is dealing with this caseload forecasting and costs, and we can go on and over and again, but ultimately we have forecasts that have been based on stale numbers that are given to us every 6 months, and what the director has said is that changes that are going to be made is, one, reviewing them every month or 6 weeks, bringing in a cadre or a group of people that are involved in this to help being involved in watching for that, so that the legislature can anticipate changes in forecast before you get hit with, by the way, read the book every 6 months, read it and weep. And then we also discuss the procedures and what procedures can be changed so that we can not have to rely on such old numbers, and also see what's being done in other states that so we can benefit from them. Now, based on all of that, and just with that in mind, are there other specific issues that you want to have addressed in forecasting at this time?
I don't understand why we, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Sure.
I don't understand why we changed this organization. Is 1 year old, is that correct?
So
I think that
the unit
that.
Is 1 year
old. So the organization is 1 year old. Why did we make that change? Did that help, hinder?
Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah.
And
great question.
Certainly.
Here, Richard,
yeah.
and Representative Wisnett. The forecast unit was created a little. Excuse me. Okay.
I'm just letting people know who's speaking now.
The forecast unit was formed a year ago, a little over a year ago, and the purpose of that was to bring in a level of expertise with respect to doing forecasting. Historically, the department had, in its former division arrays, had basically relied on the budget shops to estimate what the program caseloads were going to be. And there were many different issues that arose from that, and it was viewed as it would be a better product if there was an independent body put together that was responsible for forecasting all of the major programs of the department. And so that was what we did last biennium, in about the middle of the biennium, I guess, was to begin that process. A lot of the issues that we're dealing with have to do with multiple old data systems that have different client definitions within them. And there's just a whole host of issues that, because the department really functioned as multiple agencies, the computer systems, don't interact. And so the data that's being pulled has to be cleaned, in essence, to make it useful. And so we've got multiple processes going on to try to improve that from the standpoint of having a more unified data set that we can rely on and use for actually some of the issues that you were trying to get to with respect to, well, what's happening geographically. Right now, we don't really have that ability to go in and look at that. And we're hopeful that with what we're doing in terms of consolidating some of this data, to be able to do that type of work.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. Representative Busnett.
I agree. It sounds good. But the point is, now we've got a new system, and that system failed this time.
I think...
So do we go back to the old system?
The old system didn't necessarily work any better.
Okay.
I mean, there had been huge fluctuations in caseloads in the past as well.
Yeah, I don't know that their new system failed.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, so much as the caseload model, the historical model, was shot.
Yes.
Because it was built on the wrong, assumptions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dalton. But the point is, we have to budget based upon what they gave us, and they gave us bad data.
Yeah, but
the director indicates that.
But my contention is the bad data started 2 or 3 years ago or 4 years ago when they were putting people in the wrong programs. And Representative Barnhart builds on that by saying, by entering the discussion, this concept of the hydraulic of...
I understand that, but a lot of our budgeting is based upon what they bring to us. We did it in prisons. I did it in education. They bring us a forecast of students. They bring us a forecast of prisoners. Here they bring us a forecast of people that need their services.
Okay,
and we budgeted on
that. The basis of your concern, your angst, is, was the forecast being inept, or was it a forecast that was based, as best as you can get at that time, based on the procedures that we're using, and then we did it 6 months later, and it changed dramatically, and now we're left with with a $119.2 million hole that's relating to that part of the forecast, how do you respond to that?
Chair Richardson, I think that the important piece to this is that what we're trying to do is to build a more credible process, a process that really it mirrors the economic forecast process in terms of having external review and having steering committees and so forth. So when we talk about the forecast and the forecast group having made a forecast, that's really not a clear description of what's happening, because there are multiple stages to that. There are program people involved, there's legislative fiscal staff involved, there's budget and management staff involved. So the decision ultimately about what is the forecast going to be is a collective decision. It's not the department, individually making a decision that this is what the forecast is going to be. There's a lot of engagement, and what we're moving towards is to expand that and to expand the review process that happens in between those forecasts, so you and we can all look at what is in fact happening and say, this is much different than what we thought was going to happen, and explore together kind of the whys.
Okay, well, the concern that all of us have is that when we meet like this, look back over history, it's oops, we have a problem, we need to fix it, and is there a way that we can have smaller variations in volatility? And that's
outline some of the steps we're going to we all want the same thing, and I think that we have some steps that we're taking to do exactly that.
Okay, Representative Hanson.
Well, I think to frame this, what we need is a group of people that are very clairvoyant. And I...
Yeah.
Are you volunteering?
No. But if we look at this situation, similar to the economic forecast that bases the state revenue, if we could perfectly project state revenue, we'd never have a kicker. You know, in some years we come into special session to balance the budget. Other years we give a lot of money back based on the fact that there's a lot of external changes that, but I guess what I really want to see come out of this painful process that we're going through now is a level of credibility of which we can never get perfect because we're not going to have people that are clairvoyant. On the other hand, there should be an incredible level of integrity to the process because I've been here four terms and there's always the rumors that either the department's cooking the books or that the governor's office is underestimating caseload because they want to fund other programs or that the ways and means process is somehow lowballing numbers because for our political purposes. And what we need is a forecast that has absolute integrity to it. And it, yeah. And because it's a forecast, it's always going to be wrong. But at least everybody in the building and the public is going to have confidence that this was the best forecast that could be done and have it be constantly monitored and improved and then at least we're working on the same. Everybody's working on the same page.
It's exactly what we're trying to do. Improve the transparency, the integrity, the reliability, and the validity. And I think we've got some steps to do that. I think, however, you've indicated as well that there are going to be a variety of environmental factors, programmatic changes that will impact that. We need to be aware of that, and I can see the headline now, new DHS director hires a psychic to, no.
Start with Jim and Scherzinger and see how that goes before you go to the next.
No, we're not going to a psychic, but I think we're all looking to the same thing, and you stated it well, Rep, and you stated it much better than I in terms of what we're looking for. I think we've put together the pieces and the steps that will get us there and get us moving in that direction.
I recently read your director's... I went to the DHS website to see what's going on, and you sent out your notice or your bulletin to employees of DHS, and you said... that you know, it's a time that there's changes is inevitable. That there are always going to be changes, and that we need transparency, accountability, and you know, a willingness to change. And I think that that's correct. And I think that you know, we all appreciate the fact that you're new and that you're determined. And now we will watch to see if there are changes made. Your move toward transparency is greatly appreciated. The public has a right to know what's going on. Good news, bad news, all of it, and then from there that we're trying our best, each of us in our various capacities, to be efficient and effective in the utilization of resources that the public gives us.
Well, thank you. You know, in the end, this is we talk about this in oftentimes very sterile terms in terms of forecasting and budgets. I think in the end, why we're all here is that this is about this about people. And the decisions that we make and how we run these programs is extremely important. And that it's our responsibility to do that in the best way we can. And you know, that's my commitment, is to be transparent and accountable and to continue to try and improve and do things better and deliver services better and look at how we can be more efficient, more effective, do more with what we've got. That's what we've got to do.
Are there other questions or comments about this issue of forecasting specifically before we expand it?
Mr. Chair, I do
President
have
Flores.
Some questions, but thank you. I think I will reserve them until we expand our discussion a little bit. Maybe we can I can fold them into the discussion.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Judy. It's been suggested we take a five-minute break. My feeling is that I would, unless the director needs time, I'd rather have people step out and we move ahead. We have 45 minutes till this meeting's over. And
with some other folks that are going to come up, I can still take a quick break and we can continue.
Okay, so if anybody on the panel needs to take a break, feel free to do so, but I'd like to proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'll be passing around some material that Mr. Seike will be referring to.
Thank you. All right, we have Clyde Seike. Thank you for coming forward. The issue that we'd like to have you address is that relating to the costs and consequences of those that are not qualified or eligible for Oregon benefits that are receiving them. And so, and we don't know how widespread it is. We know that it's widely being discussed and that often discussion doesn't necessarily focus on the reality. We'd like to hear DHS's information. And then before we're done, we'll also have an opportunity to hear from Jim Ledwick, who's the president of Oregonians for Immigration Reform, for you know that viewpoint, and he'll have the opportunity to hear what you have to say.
Sure.
Let's go forward.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Seike. I'm the deputy director of the Department of Human Services. And with me here at the table today is Sue Abrams, who is the manager of our Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits for our children, adults, and families cluster. We appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion with you this morning, and really the way we want to frame this discussion, Mr. Chair, is looking at accessing services in terms of eligibility. Citizenship is just one of the eligibility criteria we look at as we work to qualify people for programs. It's one of the eligibility criteria among a long list of criteria, which includes things like income level, age, level of need, and those types of factors that we look at. We do take our responsibility to provide services to eligible people very seriously. And we are in the process of reviewing how we do that, kind of the process and standards we have in determining eligibility for clients. Our new director, Dr. Goldberg, has been very adamant about his direction that the department must do everything in its power to ensure that the right people are being served by the right programs. And what he means by that is that the eligibility standards we operate under are defined in federal law and state statute. And our job in the department is to assure that we carry out those mandates in a consistent, reliable, and accurate manner. Mr. Chair, we have provided the committee with a handout that I thought might be helpful in providing some information and maybe setting some context for the discussion. We've also received questions from you last week, and we can take this in any order you would like to take this in.
How about first, just give us a summary of what you passed out and what it's showing us and what the percentages are based on as far as your approximations.
Okay. I think what I'll do is Sue is going to go over the first part of the handout through the employment-related daycare line, and then I will pick it up from Child Protective Service and address the rest of the handout. So at this point in time, I'll turn it over to Sue.
Okay. Chair Richardson, members of the committee, on the first line is the Medicaid program, and what we provided you with is sort of, you can see at the end we've got a total, that's the total number of people we're serving in our medical program as of a certain date. It was November 15th.
Okay, now we're looking at a chart that shows various programs It shows what services that they provide, and it shows there's a column for estimated numbers of undocumented people that may be receiving benefits in that mm-hmm. program, mm-hmm. and then the total served
right.
for those that don't have a copy of this.
Right.
So we're starting with Medicaid.
And in the Medicaid program, there are very complex but strict requirements on what citizens can qualify, what non-citizens can qualify for the program. And nobody in all of our Medicaid programs, no undocumented people are eligible for the programs except for a small piece, and that's called the Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program. And in order to qualify for that program, a person needs to meet all of the eligibility requirements of any other Medicaid program except for that one piece. They're either not a citizen or a qualified documented immigrant. And so if they meet all the other requirements but they're not qualified in that area, they can qualify for only a limited number of medical services, and it's basically sort of emergency-type services.
Okay, two questions on that. One is the funding for this program. My recollection was that it's federal funding. Is it all federal?
I believe it's a federal Title 19 program required by
right.
the federal
but I mean,
government.
The cost, the reimbursement for it is mm-hmm. from the federal government, but mm-hmm. we're required to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Understand? And then the second thing is, could you tell us what is meant by emergency? I mean, how wide are these benefits? Just kind of give us a summary.
Chair Richardson, I can do that. I actually took out a part of our manual, but it's basically those, and our workers do not determine what's emergency. It is the medical provider who determines that, and it's generally those things that are life-threatening. If somebody comes in and they're in the middle of delivering, you know, having in labor,
good.
That's a service. Okay. It's very limited amount of services that are provided.
Okay, and roughly we have between 17 and 19,000 people that qualify for a Citizens Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program.
For that, Chair Richardson, that's correct. For that program, that is the number, the approximate number at a given point in time.
Okay, why don't we skip ahead, because that one is a program that people come in and sign up for, and we see that we have 17 to 19,000 people in Oregon that qualify for that. But the issue I'd like to focus on is what the extent is of illegals that are receiving benefits consuming resources?
Right. Chair Richardson, of course, we'd like to say that there are none, because, of course, we go through a fairly rigorous process of determining eligibility, and undocumented people are not eligible for our programs, except in this limited amount that we put on this chart. What we do have is a quality control process that reviews cases, and I went back and asked them to tell me, at least in the food stamp program, I don't have that level of information in some of the other programs, where we've had errors in this area, and we have some. In fact, what we find is sometimes we have, and it's very small, but sometimes less than 1% of our errors are in this area. Sometimes it's somebody who is not a citizen, doesn't meet that status that we've qualified for benefits, and sometimes it's somebody who actually does qualify and we denied. So we almost have an equal trade-off. We have probably a few more errors where our workers have identified somebody is in a status and they incorrectly made them eligible for the program. Like I said, it is less than 1% in terms of the error rate in that area. So, you know, when we do, I mean, the kinds of things we do to assure that, you know, of course we have turnover in staff, so new staff, it's a very complex, I mean, we can provide you with all the paperwork we provide our staff. It's very complex in terms of determining the status, how somebody enters this country and which status is qualifying, which statuses don't, and they're a little bit different amongst programs. So a worker might be determining eligibility for TANF, food stamps, and Medicaid, and there's a little bit of variation in terms of who can qualify and who can't.
Okay, may I share with you something from a 2002 audit of mm-hmm. The Department of Human Services Oregon Health Plan Eligibility Review?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just read you a paragraph and then have you respond to what's taken place since this came out to either change it or just get your response. It says, this is the auditors, we also found that the department provided full Oregon Health Plan coverage to some non-citizens contrary to federal law. We further noted cases lacking adequate documentation for those situations where full coverage for non-citizens is allowed. In addition, allowing a self-declaration of United States citizenship on the mail-in application for Oregon Health Plan coverage increases the risk of providing full Oregon Health Plan coverage to ineligible non-citizens. We estimate the annual cost at $1.7 million if 1% of the adults receiving full Oregon Health Plan coverage are in fact ineligible non-citizens.
Chair Richardson, I recall that report, and we did immediately change the federal requirement. We came into compliance with the federal requirement. And so that's been changed. In terms of the verifying citizenship, of course, they made assumptions. And so what we agreed to with the Secretary of State was to do a six-month project with our quality control review to see if there were any people who claimed they were citizens, and it turned out they weren't. And what we found is nobody. There was nobody who was coming in and saying they were a citizen, and it turns out they weren't a citizen. We were doing that follow-up verification.
How did you do that? Did you Social Security numbers?
I don't know all of the details of that, but the ways we can verify citizenship is through birth certificates, most generally birth certificates or passports or those kinds of things are the best source of that. Social Security numbers, a non-citizen who's qualified to work in this country can have a Social Security number, so that's not always, that doesn't always verify you're a citizen. So we usually go with the vital birth records. And passports. What happened was, so we went through this process and determined, and in fact I also went back and looked at the 3 years of data of our food stamp program, like I said, to see if we were finding that we had people who were saying they were non-citizens and we were finding they weren't. And in the few cases where we found that was a problem, it was about 0.2% where it was a problem. So what we determined because of the for the most part, administratively, to get birth certificates on every single person who comes in the door would be administratively very burdensome and probably mean that many citizens actually would either be delayed getting benefits or not get benefits because it's hard for them to obtain those. It's easy for us to get it if you're born in Oregon. It's a lot harder if you're born in any of the other states, just because we don't have access to that, easy access to that information. Okay. So,
One question I have then, it's been brought up that there are a number of illegal aliens who will just use a Social Security number and give it to their employer and will give it, you know, to qualify, mm-hmm. and that Oregon, I don't know if Oregon does any cross-checking to verify that the Social Security number given is actually one that they've got listed for that individual in Washington.
Chair Richardson, we have a couple of areas where we do cross-checks, both with Employment Division and with Social Security. And if we do find a discrepancy, then we follow up. So we do those matches regularly with Employment Division quarterly, with Social Security monthly. So we have that as a tool to follow up on.
Okay, is that done widely or a spot check?
No, that's automatic. That's an automatic. It happens for all of our self-sufficiency program cases automatically. The cross-check is an automatic one.
So TANF is a self-sufficiency case?
Yes, TANF, Medicaid, food stamps.
So all of those that apply for TANF benefits are required to give a Social Security number, and then that Social Security number is checked against Washington records to assure that it is actual.
Right. And again, when I looked at that, when I went back and looked at the food stamp quality control process we have, where we do proactively look at it and go back and verify, was that the correct Social Security numbers? In the last 3 years, we had not a single one where the person was using, anybody on the case was using the wrong Social Security number.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I think I previously mentioned, my wife's a DHS former caseworker that does food stamp reviews, and I was asking her what the process was, and it's pretty basic. A client has to show a strong level of ID, driver's license, photo, release from prison, photo documentation. The caseworker has to determine that this is who they're talking to. At that point, if they give the wrong Social Security number, and the caseworker goes to that screen, if the name and the social security number don't match, at that point the system just stops. Now, sometimes there's some confusion in terms of if a woman has reverted to the use of her maiden name without going through Social Security. So there's sometimes the name and the number don't match. But if there's a rational reason for that, then they can document that and move forward.
Is the screen that contains the Social Security number from employment records where the person may have provided that number to begin with,
it's
or is
both it Social Security and it is
federal.
It's federal, okay. And it's employment. So if somebody is working under, has given their employer a bad Social Security mm-hmm. number, mm-hmm. and they're trying to open a food stamp case under this name, but then it shows that Social Security number is a Joe Smith, a different name, right. Then that immediately comes up and it, again, stops the process. The other issue that she raised was that there's if you're in the country illegally or undocumented, and you have hopes of eventually gaining citizenship, that one of the questions that's asked is, have you ever received benefits during this period of time that you were... Mm-hmm. And most people that are here on undocumented status don't want to receive benefits because it's going to complicate them ever becoming a citizen and in the future. So they're very reluctant in terms of getting either fraudulent numbers or even applying for benefits that they're not entitled to, because that's going to be a barrier to citizenship and naturalization at a later time. So in terms of somebody that's worked in the system for 9 years, just very seldom ever seeing people really trying to milk the system in that way.
That supports your percentage.
Chair Richardson, I would agree. I think that's a real good description of how we sort of manage that process.
Okay, there's been discussion about DHS participating in mm-hmm. outreach programs to sign up illegal mm-hmm. aliens. And so I'd like to know what you know about those kinds of outreach programs, what's going on, and what's DHS's involvement.
Chair Richardson, really these programs which are held in conjunction with the Mexican consulate are really coordinated by two other state agencies, and if I'm not correct, I'll correct that. I'll get back to you with it, but I understand that it's the Employment Department and the Department of Consumer and Business Services that are coordinating these efforts, and we've been invited to participate in them. The one thing that I think it's important to point out is that we do not sign up people for benefits or determine eligibility at these programs. Primarily what we do is provide people with information of the kinds of services that we provide, and then they have to go through the eligibility determination process at whatever branch they may wish to go into. I understand the concern because we have heard from members of the legislature as well as citizens about these efforts. And what I can tell you is that on Monday, the state agencies who have been participating held a meeting regarding these sessions. And what we are kind of looking at is that this is kind of a state policy issue because it impacts more than one agency, and we will be at the table and we will be weighing in and we will be conveying the concerns we've heard from you and other people, as well as concerns that we're hearing from the public.
Mr. Chair, can I follow on that point?
Certainly, Representative Dalto.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I hear that I hear you saying, Mr. Psyche, that you're going to have a meeting with these other agencies to determine what the state policy is. I think, you know, I think we need to make something very clear here, and I think that is that the state cannot and should not be going out to proactively sign people up who aren't eligible for benefits. And I think that's the nature. This is a very complicated issue when you're dealing with what sort of services are available for undocumented persons as we go on. But I think the state, and I think what I'm looking for, and certainly some of my colleagues are looking for, is a commitment from the Department of Human Services that the DHS will not proactively go out and try to recruit undocumented people to sign up for programs. And that includes the decision to go out and participate in these carousel-type programs. I mean, that is a bad decision, and somebody needs to we need a commitment from the Department of Human Services not to participate.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Daltel, you certainly have our commitment that we are not going to be out there trying to recruit people to apply for programs that they're not eligible for. I mean, I think as far as eligibility, as I said earlier, and I believe you had left the room, is that our job is to make sure that the people who are coming in to us for services were determining eligibility correctly, and that the right people are getting the right services, the services that they're entitled to. And there's certainly, as evidenced by this handout, there are services due to either federal statutes or rules or state statutes that undocumented aliens are eligible for. And I think that's part of this discussion. And I think that where we are is outreach is a bigger question, and I think Representative Chair Richardson, you alluded to that earlier. And I think as a department, what we have to do is have a broader discussion about outreach in general and have some standards and have a decision-making process around when and where we decide to go and do outreach, because obviously any outreach efforts have some impact or consequence on the system. And so I think what I can commit to, and I'm not saying that we won't be able to commit to your requests, which I think is a reasonable request and one that needs to be strongly considered, is that, number one, we are not going to be out recruiting people for services that they're not eligible for, and we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that doesn't happen. Secondly, what I can commit to is that as a department, we're going to look at outreach in general and all our outreach efforts and say, how do we decide where we go and do outreach? What are the consequences, and where are those kinds of decisions made? And I understand your concern, and it's a concern of ours as well.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Psyche and Ms. Abrams, just in regard to outreach in general, I would like to note for the record that in November of 2004, the Oregon DHS website did have, in regard to WIC programs, that Oregon WIC program provides services to all, regardless of citizenship or alienage. Now, is that a state position or federally required?
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, if you look at the very last entry on the handout I provided, the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program is a federal program, and we administer it under the guidelines provided to us by the federal government. And they have a number of eligibility criteria that people must meet, and citizenship is not one of them. But again, we don't have a lot of flexibility there because those are federal guidelines, not state guidelines.
Thank you for helping clarify that. Follow-up?
Okay, follow-up.
Do you have in your, I guess I was looking at the Medical Assistance Program's fall 2005 forecast appendices, and noticing the numbers and the trends here noted, I see some correlation, but I'm wondering if you have a handle on, based on DHS's involvement in whatever outreach you have been doing, a correlation to the number of what we refer to as carousel events in the community. 2004, you had 12 events. 2005, you had 15. The numbers of people not only who attended but may have registered as a result of having participated in these events. Do you have any correlation in the number tracking there? I do see some increases in certain categories, but I'd like you to be able to comment on that and see if you have anything that would track with that.
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, to the best of my knowledge, we have not kind of looked at that in that context, but it's certainly something we would be willing to look at and then kind of do some analysis and get back to you and the committee on if we're seeing kind of a correlation, a cause and effect type of thing between our participation in these events and increases in some of the programs that undocumented non-citizens are eligible for. Excuse me.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
I think that I would request that we be provided that information, Mr. Chair, and I think it would be helpful to determine if there is a correlation, and then if so, were those estimated outreach efforts then plugged into the forecast that we're anticipating or that you work on, the estimates, guesstimates, forecasts, projections?
Okay. Thank you. You've answered the direct questions very openly and have helped us understand. One is that Social Security numbers are being verified on a regular basis, that you have looked into this, and you're saying that you think that the number is probably somewhere around 2% or 0.2%. Is that the number you
Chair Richardson, that is of people who are not meeting the citizen requirements.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is substantially less than what the audit was indicating occurred in 2002, so it means the trend is in the right direction, and we've had a confirmation that the agency is not allowing, and I assume that this means that you know it's not just enough for the heads to say we're not going to do this, but that you will help make sure that in your local offices that there are not well-meaning, well-intending employees that are essentially ignoring the eligibility requirements and taking that into their own hands. So with that, as I try and manage the time that we've got, I appreciate the input you gave. I'd like to invite Jim Ledwig to come forward and spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes and give us a sense of what he's seeing out there and questions that he might have. So with that, we'd like to welcome you to speak to us, Mr. Ledwig.
That's fine.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. My name is Jim Ludwig. I'm president of Oregonians for Immigration Reform. As to the question, how much of the DA's HS budget is spent on people who are not legally in the United States, I don't believe anybody has a real clear understanding of that. I read an article recently quoting Jim Edds, the deputy state Medicare director. He stated that he believed there were about 20,000 non-citizens in the Oregon Health Plan, and he had no idea whether they were legal or not, because they don't ask them if they are legal. But let me give you the public perception of how people feel what's going on. Okay. Most people see state agencies not being passive in allowing illegal aliens to take part of their programs. They see them proactively, aggressively going out and trying to get them into their programs. The most perfect example, of course, is Oregon's driver's license, where Oregon is the only state west of Mississippi that openly acknowledges it gives driver's licenses to illegal aliens. But as far as DHS goes, you've got in front of you a copy of the Carousel of Information program. This is put out by the Mexican Consul General, and as you heard earlier, in partnership with various state agencies. And as you look on there, you'll see state agencies listed that are part of that program. For those of you who are not familiar with the Mexican Consul General Carousel of Information, these are programs that are held different times at different places throughout the year, and they're only for Mexican nationals. They're the only people who can go and access those programs, and they're by invitation only. The Mexican Consul General gives out a matricular counselor card, a counselor ID. At the same time, state agencies provide information as how people can access state programs. Now, let me talk briefly about the matricular counselor card.
It's going to be very brief.
Okay. The matricular counselor card is an ID issued by the Mexican government. The only thing it's supposed to be used for is to facilitate the Mexican Consul General in aiding Mexican nationals who are in this country. That's the only indication. That plus it could be used as a form of a passport for somebody returning back to Mexico. It's not supposed to be used as a proof of somebody being legally in the United States. The reality is the only people who need a matricular counselor card are people who are illegally in the United States. So a legal alien would have a green card, a visa, or a passport. We would not need a matricular counselor card. Which really begs the question, if these agencies are going to a program in which virtually everybody there is illegally in the United States, why would they do so if they can't access their programs?
Okay, now let's stop just for a second. We've gone in our discussion with DHS today over a program called the Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program, which is a federally funded medical health care program that has over 17,000 people currently enrolled in it in Oregon who are not legal. These are citizen alien, and so some are illegal,
yeah,
and some are not.
I understand.
And so, in all fairness, DHS could be out there, whether they should or shouldn't be is a different question, but they could be out there to answer questions about that program. And we brought up with them this question of whether or not they are promoting the signing up of those that do not qualify, that are ineligible for other programs, and they're denying that that's taking place. Do you have any evidence or any indication that maybe that's taking place?
To give you an idea, in 2004, these Carousel of Information programs were attended by 7,500 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, if that's typical of what you'd expect to fall in that category only, I would be just shocked. Because I don't think the Mexican Council General screens people in advance if they're eligible or not eligible for programs. They're basically Mexican nationals living in the United States. That's the only criteria they have to come to these programs.
Mr. Ledbetter, you know, I'm not arguing with you because I agree that we need to look at this very carefully. But I do have to point out that there are a whole number of agencies that show up at these programs, and DHS was one of them.
Yeah, I understand that.
But what we're going to do is take the information which you actually previously have provided to me and follow up. By the way, I've done my own investigation on this as well and will continue as well as what's taking place through the agencies to verify, you know, trust but verify in all aspects. And I would appreciate if you would, over time, provide me with additional information and anyone else in this program or in our task force that maybe all of us through email, things that you notice, things you become aware of, so that we can help make sure that DHS is aware of those things as well.
Okay. Just to continue. The last Carousel Information Program took place in Woodburn on December the 3rd. Shortly after it was done, we sent a letter to the various state agencies asking that they tell us how many people attended, what they passed out. Among the things that DHS passed out was this pamphlet here called Food Stamps and You. And if you turn to the back page, and I'm sorry, I got copies here, but I didn't include that. But with that man's testimony, I wanted to point this out. It says in the back, you can apply for food stamps for your children or other household members who meet citizenship requirement, even if you yourself do not. Sounds good so far. You do not have to give a Social Security number, says that right here, or immigrant status information for household members who are not seeking benefits. But this is the kicker. Food stamp offices will not contact the INS with information about your food stamp application.
Well, I'm glad. I'd like to see that. And if DHS is providing any is that from
This is from DHS, yes.
And it's Tom, we have a new director, got some new leadership. It's a good opportunity to review the publications that you have, and if any publication is implying that you can circumvent the law with a wink and a nod, then obviously those ought to be pulled out of circulation and rectified.
I mean, how else could you read that? It'd be like the Oregon Department of Revenue saying, you're supposed to report all your income, but if you don't, we're not going to call the IRS.
Well, see, I'm not going to hold Director Goldberg personally responsible for something that he had nothing to do with unless it continues to happen.
I understand.
So thank you very much for bringing that to our attention.
Okay. The timing of the last one, December 3rd, I thought was really interesting in that about that time it became known to the public that DHS was $53 million over budget. Despite that, DHS sent out two employees on a Saturday to attend a program which essentially the only people there who were illegal aliens. I mean, there's no other way you can look at that.
Okay, Jim, I appreciate you bringing that forward. And Mr. Psyche has also said that the leadership for DHS is going to review not only whether it's appropriate to attend the carousel ones, but also the consequences of outreach programs that are presently being done. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to broadly participate in an outreach program for programs that you know you can't afford.
Exactly.
So they're
or people are ineligible to take advantage of it, and that's basically what I think they're doing. You know, it's my understanding that DHS has a budget. It's not an open-ended checkbook.
Absolutely.
If they do, in fact, have a budget, what it means is that any dollar that's spent on somebody who's illegally in this country is a dollar that's not spent on an American citizen or a legal immigrant who qualifies for state assistance. And that's flat-out wrong.
That's right. And the eligibility for the citizens alien waived emergency medical is not merely that you can't have other programs. They have to be eligible for all of the other aspects, meaning income and those kinds of things, except for residency. And so if that is the one benefit that is being provided, that is a legal benefit. The goal is to assure that those who are eligible can receive the benefits. And if that's not appropriate, we ought to change the benefits. But if that's the law, that should be done, but not those that don't qualify. And so it's an eligibility decision, and it's a decision on how to use your resources. And you brought this to our attention. I appreciate the fact that you are willing to kind of be a watchdog and focus on this area, but we're going to give DHS the opportunity to assure that they're in full compliance. Representative Hansen.
I don't want to be argumentative, and this is just a different perspective. And that's if there's a three-year-old kid in my district, and I've got quite a few three-year-olds in my district. If that kid is hungry or needs food stamps in order to meet basic nutrition standards for that kid, and that kid's parents are here undocumented, I don't want to see a barrier in terms of their status and worrying that they'll be turned into the INS and face deportation if that becomes a barrier to that three-year-old kid getting the benefits of food stamps.
Representative,
because that kid's a citizen of the United States and a citizen of Oregon and part of my district and deserves. I think we're a pretty compassionate society, and why we've set up food stamps is so, and especially in terms of for children and WIC, is so that those kids will be fed. If there's the barrier of the parents' immigration status, and I don't want to encourage people to come here illegally or work here illegally or anything else, but once they're here and the kid is hungry, then I think I want Department of Human Resources, Human Services, to be able to provide the benefits to that kid, whether in certain basic things like food, inoculations, public health. We don't need people sick, carrying disease, passing disease on. I mean, there's some things you do with people because they're here, not what their status is.
Okay, you know, we bring up a good point, and that is that if the brochure is worded in a way to let those that are illegal know that how to access benefits for those that are eligible, that's one thing. And certainly, if a child is eligible, they should receive the benefits. If they're not eligible and they're in need, then that's a question for our society to solve. But you don't solve it by saying it's okay to break the law. We need to change the law if that's the case. But certainly I appreciate that perspective, that the brochures are also to help people know that they're not going to get deported if they try and get benefits for a child that is eligible. I need to move fairly quickly. Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I would not want to see any public agency, when it's asked to do a public presentation, to have to predetermine who in the audience is either documented or undocumented. It's just speaking to the public.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And please keep us informed with
the thank other you. Things. Would you like to have a copy of this pamphlet then?
I would.
Certainly.
Thank you very much. And would you also hand one to Director Goldberg?
Sure. I've got one that's got DHS on it.
Give him the one that has DHS on it.
Okay.
You have it with you.
But that's one of the listed documents that you just passed out.
Okay. Any further comments on this issue before we wrap up? Yes.
Thank you very quickly, Mr. Chair. And that is, you know, even outside the discussion of food stamps or children's eligibilities for various programs that may be the offspring of undocumented or illegal residents, there is a concern from numbers in the public, and I would be remiss not to mention it because I hear from constituents about their concerns when they perceive that people who are not eligible are receiving medical benefits or whatever else they may be receiving, and certain folks that are residents of this state and are citizens of this country are deemed ineligible, judged by some of the same criteria. So that is a concern that I hear.
Thank you. Any further comments on that? Yeah, as we look at the back of this, this does indicate that it's a USDA brochure, and maybe there's another one, but just to clarify the record, that the pamphlet that we're looking at is not a DHS pamphlet.
I got one that has DHS on it at home.
Okay, that's great.
I brought that as I had more of those than the one with DHS, and I promised Mr. Goldberg that I would send him a copy of the one with DHS on it.
All right.
Would you like to have a copy of it also?
I would, please. Thank you. All right, members of the task force, are there any questions before we... I have some concluding remarks and we wrap up. Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I've worked with you during the session. I know you're workaholics. We're not going to change that, but your letter to us about the subcommittees, are we going to pursue that, and is there any interns that we're going to have to help me with Representative Hansen's and I?
Okay. The question relates to how is the task force going to function, and we're not having subcommittees because subcommittees have a whole different legal definition and consequences. What we have is a huge organization, obviously. Isn't that right?
It's a big place, yes.
It is. And so we have different compartments or divisions in the agency, and rather than have the task force meet 4 or 5 times in a 14 or 15 month period, take testimony, and then, you know, maybe we get something done or maybe we don't. What we're going to try and do is have some more individual activity, and then when we come together, it'll be mainly to clarify and report, and then if there's things that need to be brought out from the work that's been done individually, then it can be, you know, we can make sure the right people come and testify, we zero in. So in DHS, what I'm asking and what we discussed and everybody's agreed to is that we have some sub-teams, and that for the seniors and people with disabilities, that division of DHS be looked at by Representative Wisnett and Representative Hansen, and that the area...
That's appropriate based on our age.
Well,
the older the
disabled part. I don't know if there's a conflict of interest there or not, but there's wisdom with this.
Yeah.
The second is the children, adults, and families, and we've asked that Representative Flores and Representative Witt will work together and identify areas, and we'll be in coordination through conference calls regularly with each of the teams as to areas that you'd like to focus in on, because you can't do it all. It's just too huge. And the legislature can't do it. And when we wait until we're in session, we really can't do it because there's too much going on. There's too much, not enough time. And so DHS will give all the support that is needed to answer your questions, to help you understand what's going on in those areas that you choose to focus on. We'll coordinate, and then, you know, we'll come back periodically as a task force to decide, you know, what we can do about it and what, you know, where we should go with the information you're gathering. And that we have special focus on alcohol and drug treatment programs for it, and because it's such a huge need and it's so expensive, and with meth and the other problems that we're facing, the consequences to our entire society are so broad that the speaker specifically asked if we would focus on that one program. And so Representative Dalton, Representative Barnhart will be focusing on that and using your experience and your knowledge and your time to zero in on looking for you know, evidence-based programs, how things are working, what the consequences are. Are we measuring things the right way? How do we compare with other states or other programs? Are there ways that we can be more effective in the utilization of the resources that we have for alcohol and drug? And then I'm on the task force for the Oregon Health Plan, and so with Sandy Lisurka, we will be working kind of in a team focusing on the Oregon Health Plan. She's also the legislative administrator for that task force, as well as management. So I'll be doing OMAP and DHS management, and we've been working together trying to put together an organizational chart for the last month and a half so that we can actually say, this is what DHS is. And we still do not, I don't have an actual number yet for the number of employees that are in DHS, but we're working on it so we can know where they're employed, how it's structured, so that there can be a kind of an evaluation on, you know, best size and best processes and all that. And that you know, we can't even scratch the surface on that, because that is a focus that consultants have, whole businesses that they just go around and do that for large organizations and companies. But we can look at it and make recommendations by the end of this interim as a group as to possibly pre-session legislation that should be passed, things that we can do to assist DHS. We're here to assist the new director and his team to be able to accomplish the goals that they have to make the organization more transparent, more efficient, deal with change in a way that is, you know, is appropriate when there's change to be needed. There's no preconceived conclusion as to what we're going to do or what we're going to recommend. It's all about trying to review DHS as we can and assist in with DHS to help it be a better organization and function better. On that regard, I think that it's premature to us for us to schedule a meeting next week. And so let's save those resources that we would have to expend by having another task force meeting next week for another time later on in the session or the interim. So, you know, we'll be in contact, Sandy and I, with each team, and we'll have a telephone call, a conversation, conference call, where we'll discuss, you know, the steps and where you're going to go and how to do it and what support we can be for you in that. So there's a final issue, and that relates to what we've done here today. There was two issues that the state of Oregon is confronted with this $172 million shortfall. One is, what are we going to do to solve the problem? And the other is, what are we going to do to help assure that we have less of a problem in the future by making forecasts more reliable and less volatile? The focus of our time has all been on number two. There's been no discussion, as you know, as to what are we going to do about, you know, say there are less cases in TANF, and maybe it's not 172 million, maybe it's only 164 million. It's a lot of money, whatever it is, and it is not in the budget, and it has to be resolved. And DHS is an executive branch agency, and we as a legislature are not in the same position to propose a solution that, with all of their expertise, that they can propose, and with the governor's office and all the expertise that he has on health plan. And so, essentially, as we draw this meeting to a close, it's to remind DHS that you have a week, a little over a week, until the e-board, and that it's expected that the governor and DHS will work together and come forward to the e-board with a proposed solution to the shortfall that is confronting the DHS budget. It's not fair to Oregon to let it sit and just see how it all works out. I mean, we expect, all of Oregon expects DHS to be a well-oiled machine that acts that functions in an efficient and effective manner. You're like a huge insurance company with the Oregon Health Plan, and a huge delivery of services to the elderly, and a huge delivery of services to foster programs and all that. And these are all, in other places, corporations. And no corporation could look at a budget and say, we have $172 million hole, and that we're just going to wait and see how it all works out during the last quarter of the biennium. You would address, is the figure correct, which is a forecasting issue. What is the basis for it? Because that's important for long-term planning. But what are we going to do about it? And so the e-board is looking to the governor and the director of DHS to come forward and say what the plan is to solve the hole that DHS finds itself in. It's one thing to discuss why we have it, but it's another thing to discuss how it's going to be solved. And so it's expected that next week there will be a presentation of a plan of action. And the governor and DHS director, you know, you have staffs of experts that understand this, and if there is no plan of action, it means that, as far as I'm concerned, there has been a dereliction of duty, but what it really means is that a solution has to be solved, and if one doesn't come from you, the e-board or the legislature, not the e-board, we can't solve it, but the legislature is going to have to come up with solutions for that. It's not going to just be able to sit. And so the better solution is to have those that really understand these problems and the alternatives to come forward with a plan of action so that the legislature is not forced in a situation where leadership has to get together and say, okay, what are we going to do to solve this? We got a $172 million hole, and we don't know a whole lot about it because we're legislators, but we're going to solve it one way or another. So we're inviting and asking and requesting the governor and DHS to come forward at the e-board to make sure that there is a solution that's been proposed. We know that one thing, and that's that Oregonians deserve a solution, and it's not a alternative that is acceptable for this to just be allowed to sit. And so we need to have a rational decision and a solution and a plan of action. And so we look forward to the e-board to see how we're going to deal with that next week. Comments? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that one of the things that I'll be doing in the next day or two is to check in with Dr. Goldberg about how he wants to make his offices available to us as Representative Delto and I in work on this drug and alcohol program that you've outlined. A different topic. I think it's really important as the legislature, as the e-board, as this committee and others consider the issue that you were that you just raised, that we think clearly about the about both the legal import and the political issue that's involved in this kind of a budget shortfall. On the one side, I think it's very important for us to think about this clearly. On the one side, the legislature has a responsibility to make certain that we have a balanced budget by the end of the biennium. No question whatsoever about that. On the other side, we also need to recognize that we have contracts with the federal government and with others and our own mandate system to make services available and programs available to the people who need it. And in that sense, there's no shortfall at all. It's simply an operation of programs. The shortfall is a budgetary one. It's not a legal one. And so recognizing those issues, then I think are among the things that the governor, the e-board, and ultimately perhaps the legislature needs to consider as we talk about as we talk about where to go. Of course, the last piece of it is that unlike the situation that we were in 3 years ago, there is no danger of the Treasury running out of money, which we were at that point terrified of. And so we don't have to do something precipitously in order to deal with the Treasury running bare and difficulties actually paying our bills. So in that sense, it's a little different situation than we were in 02. I think we all appreciate the value of that reality. Yeah. And if we can think clearly about those three different factors in the issue that you raise, I think that that will be well served.
Thank you. If there's no further, is there anything else anybody else feels they have to say?
Yes. I thank you very much. I think that, and I do not wish to reiterate comments that have been made, but yet another reminder, and Representative Wisnett had inferred it earlier in comments, that as we look for the accountability mechanisms and the reforms, if you will, that need to be made within the structure, it is, once again, it is not our responsibility, as you said, Mr. Chair, to do that. The governor's office and the department are certainly accountable for those efforts. We are oversight and responsible to the citizens of this state, excuse me, however, and so a lot of times the arrows are pointed at us. I do want to also remind each of us that, if you recall, in January of 2003, Measure 28 failed. In between Measure 28 and spring of 2004, we had Measure 30 coming up, and the Department of Human Services, there was a banner headline. There was a $179 million shortfall. Measure 30 was, by all terms, a flamer. People said not only no, but heck no. And within weeks, I think it was about 8 weeks, another banner headline that the Department of Human Services found $120 million. So there was a $300 hydraulic in within a matter of short number of months. And so those are the types of things that the citizens recall. And that's why they look at us. And that's why it is really incumbent that we encourage and work with. And as Dr. Goldberg is wont to say, that's why we're here, to make this not happen again.
Thank you, Representative Henson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real short comment, and that is, I think we do need to determine, and probably through some time and due diligence, the extent of whether the $172 million is a current figure. If it's something of close to that proportions, without dramatically cutting benefits that I don't think anybody in the legislature or the governor's or the executive side wants to do, it's going to require some level of legislative involvement in order to rebalance the budget. And so I think that certainly we need leadership from the Department of Human Services, but in terms of guiding us to what the path should be, but we're all in this together, that it's going to have to take both the legislature and the executive working hand in hand to solve what I see as a very solvable problem. It's just a question of what are the legislative tools that we have available and the resources that we have available to come up with the best solution.
Okay, thank you. Certainly we are not in a position to start having committee meetings on what the solution ought to be. That's why we have an executive branch, and we know the governor's office has got to be working on this probably as we speak. But the one concluding remark is that the e-board is next week, and the legislature awaits the governor's plan to solve the DHS shortfall. Thank you all for being here. The meeting is adjourned.
Representative, you are certainly...